Today's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Shudder. Brought to you by AMC Network, Shudder is not only a premium streaming video service, but an experience unlike any other. Created for fans of all degrees of thriller, suspense, and horror, Shudder is home to the largest and fastest-growing human-curated selection of high-quality, spine-tingling, and provocative films, TV series, and originals, and there's always something new and unexpected for Shudder members to explore.
New this week, Neil Gaiman's Likely Stories, adapted from the dark tales of author Neil Gaiman. This collection of distinct, odd, and brilliant short stories is both cinematic and strange. In each film, each character is compelled to share their story, and we're drawn into their very act of telling tall tales. While each episode has its own lead character, they are backed by an ensemble cast that play across all four bold and original films. If you enjoyed American Gods, Coraline, or Stardust, you'll love Neil Gaiman's Likely Stories.
Shudder is available for $4.99 a month or $49.99 with an annual membership. But our listeners can get a free month by entering promo code SHOCK at checkout. That is SHOCK at checkout.
Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of thrillers, suspense, and horror available to stream anywhere.
Okay, and welcome to episode number 63 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galuzzo. Sitting with me, Mr. Elric Kane.
Hi, Rob.
What's up, buddy? How are you?
I'm pretty good today.
Pretty good.
Feeling good.
Pretty good.
Pretty good.
Also with us, Rebecca McKendry.
Hello, guys.
Hi, welcome. And Mr. Ryan Turk.
Hello.
The whole gang is here.
Woo-hoo.
Briefly, always.
Briefly.
Yeah, Turk's bailing on us
again. Just giving you a heads up. Listen, I got to duck out for some work.
He's a businessman. He's got business to take care of, right? So... You should have the New York City theme from Cannibal Ferox every time you exit.
Exactly.
The show.
Is that like disco theme or
it's business?
Things. Yeah. It's business. I picture like
on our music theme music episode we said when you listen to that, that means you got shit to do.
Yep. See, so I always picture the soundtrack to Secret of My Success or Walking on Sunshine. Those are kind of the two like quintessential 80s. I'm doing business type
songs.
I
want that tentacles theme though every time you leave the room, Brian. I think that's
I think it should be the Torgo Manos Hands of Fate theme.
Now we're getting
crazy. It's getting crazy here, guys.
I don't remember at all.
Are you serious? It was my ringtone for a while.
Oh, of course it was.
But because of that, he's asked us all to prepare cocktail napkin pitches for our picks of the week.
Absolutely not.
He said they have to fit on a cocktail napkin.
You continue for it. I just want to tell you that I watched Shock 'Em Dead this week.
Oh,
what?
Shock 'Em Dead.
I'm in love with a slut.
Yeah. can somebody soundbite that and play it forever? Rebecca saying that is my new favorite thing.
Oh my god.
Wait.
It's a song in Shock 'Em Dead.
All right, let's just jump right in. What did you see? Let's get Shock 'Em Dead with
Tracy Lords. Oh. I'll show you the poster watch I'm holding up, which finds Tracy Lords in a slinky black dress.
Wow.
And a hair metal guy holding a switchblade behind him. So this came out in 91, directed by Mark Fried. There were two things that were very, very important to a young Ryan Turek at this time.
One was Tracy Lords.
Yes. Yeah. The other one was Betty Page. And anything, Becca's giving me a look like vintage babes. Ew.
Yeah.
And I worked at a comic book store at the time, and Shock 'Em Dead was strangely on the back of like some comic books and Fangoria and stuff like that. So it took me many, many years later to finally see it. But I was at Amoeba about 2 weeks ago. This was on sale. Slasher Video put it out. And I was like, you know what? Slasher Video, Tracy Lords, Shock 'Em Dead. I'm going to watch this finally. almost over 25 years later.
And my glance was not your lust after vintage babes. It was that you did not include that kick-ass quadruple-necked guitar as things that young Ryan Turk, what the fuck is wrong with you, Tarek?
I know.
Well, metal.
I'm thinking about legs. Shock 'Em Dead is basically your typical... I'm an aspiring musician and I strike a supernatural bargain with someone sinister to achieve babes and money and talent. And in this case, it is some dope who works at a pizza place. And he winds up running into like a voodoo priestess on the streets of what looks like Venice. Huh. And she he basically makes a bargain with her. And in doing so, he gets some pretty rad big hair, this aforementioned guitar that Becca was talking about.
It's epic.
It really is. And he gets all the babes. But all the babes are also highly cursed because of whatever dark deal they struck. So everybody's very, like, emotional. The emotional anchor is rich here, man.
It's the hair. The emotional anchor is the hair.
Wow. And the one thing that all these cursed people cannot do is eat. That is their weakness. So if you're able to put food, if you're able to make them eat, then they die.
That sounds kind of gross.
It's very unusual. So by the end of the movie. End of the movie, you got somebody running around shoving food in people's faces and forcing them to eat food.
All right. Well,
but the songs that this guy writes are so, I mean, you could tell that this was like the end of the hair metal phase, because I'm in love with a slut is one of them, but they all kind of have that very kind of self-aware 80s vibe where it's almost like a satire.
Yeah,
a lot of it.
It is a satire. Yeah. What I can't believe they got away with is playing Hendrix.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
like somehow.
Yeah, that seems.
They
like
got
that.
Some Hendrix in there, and I was like, wait a second, very unusual. But
nudity?
Yes, of course. Okay. Nudity across
Tracy
the board.
Lord's nudity?
This is like pure. USA up all night fodder. Okay. Like I was just missing Rhonda Shear hosting it, you know?
I've never heard of this.
What?
You've never heard of this?
I've never even heard of this.
Oh my
god. That, I love this. The first review on Amazon is before Jem and the Holograms, there was Shock 'em Dead.
It's true. It's true.
That is Jem and the Holograms is in the '80s.
Yeah, I know. It's actually no,
so it's not true at all.
Wait, Jem, yeah, Jem.
No,
was
but they
80s.
Meant the Blumhouse version.
Yeah, that's what they're talking about.
That is very true.
You totally, everything was from Shock 'em Dead, completely. Yeah.
But no, this was like one of those kind of like movies that you just discover at the video store and you know you're in for a good time. My only thing is it feels like a 2.5 hour movie. Mm. I had to watch it in two chunks because I had a work thing I had to deal with. But when I came back, I was like, oh, I'm almost done with this movie. No, I had another hour to go. Yeah. I only watched the first 30 minutes and it felt like
– Yeah, pacing's like, everything.
Yeah, oh, God. But anyway, Shock 'em Dead. Interesting. The special features on this Blu-ray are fun. And I've been trying for a Slashback Video to find the giant Tracy Lord standee for this.
Ooh.
I found it on eBay.
Too much, though.
How
much? For my blood. It's like $300.
Oh, my gosh. Man. For a cardboard Tracy Lord.
Like, they had a shrunk down countertop one for $150. I was like, what?
For the longest time, Shock 'em Dead was like nearly impossible to find on anything else but VHS.
Right.
So I had the Shock 'em Dead VHS for a long stretch. And now I ended up procuring a DVD version
of
it somewhere.
Well, if you are listening to this and you can lend Ryan your Tracy Lord's life, blow up doll or whatever the fuck it is, please contact them.
The
Slashback Video.
Yeah. The Blu-ray is culled from, like, I'm presuming VHS elements.
A little rough.
Oh, it doesn't look that
good. There's a little warning. It's a little rough.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Right. Shock 'em Dead.
Wow. Well, I am the I've seen the most anticipated horror movie of the year.
Oh, and are you allowed to talk about it?
Yeah, why not?
Heck yeah.
I went as a fan.
I don't want to hear much.
No, and that's the thing, just so everybody knows, because I'm actually going to talk about two pretty prominent movies this episode, and it's going to be spoiler free on both.
Yeah.
But I'm talking about It, which all of us have been pretty excited about. And there was just one of those sign up today to go see it things. My friend Andrew Cash signed up, called me, and he's like, hey, you want to go see it in an hour? And I'm like, yep, I will be right there.
Rob texted us from the screening, and all of us were what the fuck are you doing?
It's like in the midst of like this text chain talking about work, and Rob's like, guess where I am?
Yeah.
I'm at It.
Well, it was a long text chain, and I figured that would shut them all up. So hey, but I gave Ryan my pin. I got a pin at the event. So there you go. So I'm going to keep it completely spoiler-free, but basically I loved it. It's great. It really, really is a great movie. And there's a lot of reasons why I thought the director, Andy Muschietti, am I saying it correct?
Yep.
He actually showed up and introduced it, which I thought was super cool. His love and reverence for the book is very evident. Now, here's the weird thing. Here's why it's not a perfect score for me. I give it like a 4.5 out of 5. The reason it's not perfect is because I love and know the TV movie so well. And I know a lot of our listeners probably do too. I used to come home from school and watch it every day after, wow. especially the kids segment. Mm-hmm. I used to watch it every day after school for a long period of time. So I love the TV movie, and it's almost impossible for me to not think of those actors and characters. Mm. At the same time, I'm currently now listening to the audiobook version of the book because I've never finished it. It's always defeated me as a kid. It's just too much.
Long, yeah.
But I downloaded the Steven Weber read the audiobook. So I'm almost done with that. I've only got 22 more hours to go. So there's that. And I mean, I've already been through 40. So I have both those things fresh in my mind. And the only thing I will say is that what I like about this movie is it is very different from the TV movie. It is very different from the book. Mm. And what's good about it, but it tonally absolutely 100% captures the book, or at least how I felt reading the book or listening to it. And the reason I think the differences are good are because that means that no matter how much you know the material, there's a lot of surprises there.
Cool.
And so that was what was exciting for me, is that although I knew certain things that would come, and I actually kind of missed certain things that weren't there, because look, there's only so much. It's two hours and 20 minutes. There's only so much of that book that you can get into a 2-hour and 20-minute movie.
Oh yeah.
But what they did do, the things they concentrated on, the updates that they made, because of course it takes place in 88, 89, so that the adult version will take place in present day. But the way that they adapted that story to take place in the 80s is excellent. And it reminds me of a lost movie from the 80s, because back when we gave a shit about characters, like, you will absolutely fall in love with these kids as the Losers Club. Like, I mean, everybody across the board acting wise is terrific. And so it's great. And the half star that prevents it from being perfect, and this is just because of knowing the material so well, it is all the kids. It's just the kids' story. So after 2.5 hours, which it doesn't feel like 2.5 hours, as soon as it's over, you're like, I'm ready for the next three. Like, I will sit here for another 3 hours because I want to see the adult story now, like right now, the second. Mm-hmm. And I think because the adult story is not in there, it makes me feel like there's something missing. Mm-hmm. There's not. And narratively, because both the book and the TV movie mix both, like, throughout the entire narrative. So it's a little weird just getting that story from the 80s from start to finish.
Right.
But it's great. And I think it is going to only get better on repeat viewings, because there's so many – I miss horror movies like this with the amount of nuance that's in it.
Cool.
And I think even Stephen King said he's endorsing it a lot for obvious reasons, but – he had just done another video saying he watched it for the second time and loved it even more the second time, because there was things that even he didn't pick up on that he saw, you know, on his repeat viewing of it. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, you guys are going to love it. It's a great movie, and I missed this kind of movie. And
did
I remember
it play,
when we
played the audience, did it freak people out?
Here's the thing: it is absolutely and this is what I think Andy did that was terrific, and what I mean about changing little aspects of it. It is a fucking roller coaster ride.
Mm.
I can't. And look, everybody that I was in the audience with were all fans. Like, it wasn't press or anything like that. I don't remember the last time that I heard that many screams, because literally it is paced like a roller coaster ride where you get scares every, whatever, 10, 15 minutes.
Right.
But the cheers, there's at least 3 or 4 very satisfying moments.
Because they're on the kids' side.
And you love the kids. Yeah. If you know the book and the material, you could probably guess what moments I'm talking about. But like, yeah, they started cheering at several points throughout the movie. And I think that's why this is going to be so fucking huge, is because it is an audience-pleasing movie.
Excellent.
And yeah, it's going to be big, so.
We went to the It Experience.
Right.
Hollywood and Vine. They actually, if you guys don't know, Warner Brothers built a haunted house on an empty lot on the corner of Hollywood and Vine.
Mm-hmm.
And so, this is an area in which there are a lot of bars and clubs and stuff like that. So to see those surround a spooky house that's been fenced off and little Georgie standing on the front porch holding his red balloon is very, very unusual. But it was a really cool, basically haunted maze walkthrough experience. You begin in the main foyer of the house and then work yourself up the stairs and then back down into the bowels of the house until you're in the sewers where it lives. And they use a lot of fun trickery, from lighting to animatronic gags to projections on fog that's creeping off the
thing. Oh, that's
cool. It's
cool. That's a cool effect.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lot of fun. A lot of people... one of our creative execs here went last night. She stood for 2 hours and experienced it. She was like, it's good. It's good. 2 hours is a little bit long, yeah. long of a wait. We were able to kind of walk right in, so we had a better experience.
Yeah, that's how but I feel about any days. If I have to wait that long, it's yeah. none is going to yeah.
– That's how I am at Universal. Yeah. Like, if I don't have front of line
pass.
I don't know
we're
if I can
spoiled.
Do it.
Yeah.
We are spoiled, but it's the way to go.
I don't have that attention span.
All right.
So,
who's up?
Go. I'll go because I watched Vicious Lips.
I won that at trivia and
you
then
did?
Didn't watch it and then somebody I traded it with somebody but
so Vicious Lips, I didn't know anything about this movie going in. I just liked it because it had like the front cover looked very 1980s kind of hair metal where they
got aerobics
or aerobics but it
on,
also
in space.
Yeah, it kind of had this like sword and sandal feel uh-huh. to it where it almost felt kind of gladiator and they're in space. Like I was like, there's so much going on in yeah. this, I must see it. so I watched Vicious Lips from 1986, which is actually the sequel to Radioactive Dreams, which actually after I started watching it, I was like, I kind of see how it's a sequel. It's a very loose sequel. We'll
written and directed
it.
By Albert Pooin.
Who is still making movies now. I immediately started Googling him and I'm now obsessed with that man's career
wow.
and need to watch all of his stuff. Vicious Lips, it is about a girl who's auditioning for this kind of talent show and she gets kind of kicked off the stage, but this producer finds her and is like, you're hot. I think you'll be great with my metal band. And it's set in this futuristic society where this kind of overlord is dictating television and who gets to put their band on television. So they start on this spaceship. So this overlord calls up the manager dude and is like, if you can get a band together, they can be on the show tonight. And so he's like, new girl, you're now our lead singer. Here's a whole bunch of really angry women with big giant hair who will teach you how to look badass and go do songs. And then they start on this spaceship, but for some reason, the same spaceship that they're transporting the band on, they also put a serial killer werewolf on. And then hilarity ensues where the spaceship ends up crashing. And then, of course, the serial killer werewolf, who was never identified as a werewolf, they just call him a serial killer, but he's clearly like part wolf, breaks out. And then crazy shit happens. And will they make it to the show? Pretty much at that point, it becomes Get Me to the Greek or Get Him to the Greek or whatever it is. So, yeah, it's kind of balls out crazy. If you are reminiscent of 1980s hair metal movies, this is a great pairing with Shock 'Em Dead, actually. I would kind of say
it sounds like
Vicious Lips and Shock 'Em Dead would make an amazing double feature. The acting's a bit rough in it. Apparently the lead, though she's lovely to look at, she was apparently a playmate. The music's awesome. The acting's a bit rough. And there were parts where I literally looked at my husband and was like, I have no fucking clue what's going on here. But it's fun. So, yeah, I had fun with it. Vicious Lips, 1986.
Mm. On on the Amazon editorial review, in the cold of space, they're the hottest band around.
The music was actually really good. Like, wow. Immediately afterwards, I was like, I need this record. I will probably never watch the movie again. Like, I think once is enough for this. But the music was, like, really nice. So
awesome. Almost metal, but not quite. One of the characters looked metal. Is a little something I know you saw, and I saw on Netflix.
Oh.
Death Note.
And I think Ryan, too.
Adam Wingard's
We've all
Death
seen
Note.
Death Note.
Oh.
Yes. Let's discuss.
And I think we'll all be kind of – we might have all very different
I think we're
going to
be different, but we'll see.
And where is this currently available?
It's on Netflix.
It's
made for
Netflix now.
Okay. Well, let's just start by saying – because I think the important part is let's – before we say if we liked it or not – what our experience with Death Note? I had zero.
Zero as well.
Okay.
I've seen the feature, the live action feature film.
See, I've
none
read
of the sequels.
No,
okay.
No sequels.
And none of the animation. The weirdest thing for me about it, because there's a lot I liked about it. I think the style of it's a lot of fun. Like he still is a stylish director. Is the first 20 minutes feels like it could have been. If this was a 6-part Netflix series, it could have been like 2 hours. That first 20 minutes, the way it whizzes through things
yeah.
in a way that was almost like, oh, but I want a little more. It's gone.
See,
you know?
I kind of found that refreshing and I liked it.
Yeah.
I was like, you know what? I'm glad I don't have a 10-episode series to get through. I was like, I like that this is just a one night feature for me. But
yeah.
Anyways,
I really felt like when it ended, I was like, oh, if that had been a 6-part, that yeah. was just my gut was a 6-part. Mm. Netflix thing might have been really cool. You could have gone deeper on certain stuff at the start. There was a lot I liked about it, but especially, you know, the style. But I felt the writing felt rushed and forced a lot of the lines. And I just didn't think it was a well-written film to me. But I did think Adam did a good job with it in a visual sense that just kept you kind of on your toes and kept me in it. But, like, yeah, I just never cared.
Yeah.
You know, well, I wanted to care. But
I liked it a lot. There is a lot of story packed into there, and it goes a little too fast. But at the same time, for whatever reason, I just still found it satisfying by the end. I was like, oh, that was pretty cool.
And for Netflix, it's still a fun thing to kind of come home to.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I liked the creature. I knew nothing about it, so I liked the creature. Of course, yeah. Willem Dafoe is, like, as the creature. And as usual, I love Adam's, like, music choices. Like, yeah. I ended up buying 2 synthwave albums. As soon as it was over, I was like, I learn all about synthwave through Adam Wingard movies, apparently.
That's funny.
So I generally liked it. The only weird thing I saw on Ryan before we even recorded today was that which I don't think is fair criticism at all, but this is one of the many that's being hated on before it even premiered for whitewashing. But I was like, well,
it's not really whitewashing.
No, because the other antagonist is a black character, and there's Japanese actors in the Japan section. So I don't think it's guilty of that. I think it's guilty of squeezing a lot of the mythology into one movie.
Yeah,
and it's Western culture. They're just taking it to Western culture. So that's probably why people
are freaking out. But at the same time, it's like the Japanese have already exploited the shit out of this. Like, there's already 2 live action movies, the anime, a bunch of spin off. Like, so it's like, what do you want? It's like
nothing we didn't do to Godzilla.
Yeah. Ryan?
There was an emotional disconnect with it, and it wasn't just because of the material. Like, you know, my kid is big into Death Note. I'm familiar with the world. I'm not familiar with the deep mythology and the ties to the live action and what liberties they took.
Did she watch the movie with you?
Yeah, she got halfway through and then she left.
Well, remember Hero's Journey stuff where there's that call, the refusal of the call, right? Like, thinking about Luke Skywalker. In this, as soon as you get the book, first thing he does when he meets a hot girl, hey, just so you know, I have a book that kills people. Like if you tell someone straight away.
Not only that, it was the getting the book and immediately putting someone's name in and seeing the cause and effect of it.
And that's what I mean. There's no push and pull. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And there's that kind of like, there's no, it didn't feel like there were consequences. And it felt like the story started grazing over all those consequences in really flashy, fun montages with the Adam Wingard music, which is cool, you know? But there was just that kind of like emotional disconnect between me and Light, the character, and the girl who what was her name? I forgot her name. But then you also have Elle, who is this kind of mysterious figure operating behind the government, you know, the agencies. And it just felt otherworldly, you know? It just didn't feel grounded when you have – yes, you have like a death god kind of situation going on, so it's already fantastical. But if there's going to be anything that roots anything in our world, like make the characters, like the human characters grounded. Elle was just like the dude eating candy nonstop, and he was just like
eccentric,
out there,
if you will.
Very eccentric, very eccentric, but he also just didn't feel real.
He's straight into more comic book world, like Jessica Jones' character who could just pop in at some point, even though she's more grounded.
Yeah.
So, although I love Shea Whigham. I thought he was the most grounded. MVP.
Oh, absolutely. Shea Whigham is fucking the bomb. But yeah, it was just by the end, when it ended, I was just kind of like, okay, cool. Yeah. You know,
it did, and it ends kind of abrupt. I think a lot of it's just like it doesn't make you work for anything, and therefore you don't care as much.
Yeah, you know, and also when you have so much to catch up on in the third act, when a character makes a giant decision, and then in those final moments you're getting it all downloaded to you, you don't want to leave on that note.
Yeah,
on that death note.
But I definitely don't. I mean, but I definitely don't think it deserves the hate it's getting. But that's obviously coming from passionate people.
No. Yeah,
and if they're passionate,
I understand
then,
that too. Yeah, they have that right. Yeah. I mean, all valid criticism.
Yeah,
you know. But yeah, I think for a Netflix original that just popped up this weekend, I thought it was a pretty cool way to kill 120.
It really felt to me almost like a pilot.
Yeah.
Like, okay, cool. I'll watch the series. Oh, what? There's no more?
Well, there is a lot to Death Note. I mean, I've only read the mangas and seen some of the Japanese films, but I mean, it keeps on going forever. Yeah. Huh. So I assume they could expand if it does well.
Yeah.
And we'll never know. Netflix will never tell us.
This over the weekend, Cinematic Void has been doing a string of Stephen King films, apropos. So I took the whole family to go see Cujo and Pet Sematary.
Hey,
it was also paired with Graveyard Shift, but a triple feature.
Getting late.
Come on, kids, hop in the car. Carl, let's go see Cujo.
Yeah, let's go see Cujo.
Cujo's the greatest.
So we went to go see Cujo, grabbed a little dinner beforehand with some surprise guests, which I was freaking out about. But we went with Mark Fortin and Josh Miller and surprise guest. It was funny because, well, first off, Cinematic Void is the bomb. Like, I love what they're doing there. I love their pre-show. During the pre-show, they were playing old IT TV spots for the TV show.
Oh, wow.
And I haven't seen those in forever. Mm. Wow. So it was like, IT coming to TV tomorrow. And I was like, oh, my God. I remember, like, staying up late watching that, videotaping it myself. Yeah. And then they would show, like, old Stephen King trailers and stuff like that. But, you know, Cujo and Pet Sematary over time, you know, William Bibbiani and I did this thing on YouTube called The Kings of Horror. If you type in Kings of Horror on YouTube, you'll find our entire series in which we tackle every single theatrical Stephen King film release from beginning to end. I think it ended at Carrie, which is when we were doing it. And I think I shit talked Cujo a lot.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I've always loved
it. Now seeing it on a big screen with, you know, fresh eyes, that movie is stellar.
Yeah.
It is a good
one. We had Mike Williamson showed on 16mm Jump Cut, and that was the time where I was like going, oh, yeah, this movie really holds up.
It really holds up well.
Louis
really
Teague is a good director.
Yeah, he is very good. Great, great tension that I did not – I think you just don't get, I don't know, maybe on the small screen because – you know, all those, you know, every time Dee steps out of the car and like she does this kind of moment where she's like, I think she's either going for the gun or the bat, but she steps out of the car. Cujo's not around. She looks under the car because we had just seen Cujo sleeping on the other side. He's gone. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden that's when he attacks and you're like, oh my God. And then and then it's like a three-tiered thing. It's fighting him outside the car, fighting him halfway in the car, and then fighting him in the car with little Danny in the background, her kid, all fucked up and screaming. And it was like such a great three-tiered action scene with this dog.
People talk about elevated horror. What they really are probably saying is horror films with good acting.
Yeah.
Really, it's only difference. Right. And good or a bad horror film.
This little kid, he is spectacular. She's amazing.
It's one of my favorite
performances. It's one of the best things he's done.
By her. She's just believable as a mom. It feels like she would do anything to save that kid, anything. And it's kind of amazing in that way.
I appreciate Cujo, but I can't watch it. Like, it's the dog thing. It's like I've never been
harmed to dogs.
Yeah, I can never, and I know
it is.
It's
I mean, there is a movie you could do that's all from Cujo's eyes, which is just poor Cujo. He's like, oh shit, I got bit by a bat, and now I'm losing my mind.
No, it's meant to be a little sad. He's like, I really feel sad at the start
for some reason. And I mean, I have not seen it in decades because it affected me the same way. But when I saw it as the kid, even though that I watched it as a horror film, it kind of echoed in my soul as like Old Yeller or Where the Red Fern Grows. And I can't watch it. Like,
I think you should watch it now as a mother.
Okay.
I think you'd have a totally, because again, Dee Wallace, the performance she gives and the idea of like she will do anything to protect her kid.
That I get.
It's pretty amazing. Yeah.
And it's very adult in terms of the sexual relationships. The adults in it are very complex.
Yeah.
The boy is all of us when we're kids. How he has to run and jump into his bed. And so it's like, it's hitting on a lot of tiers.
Yeah.
I definitely think it's a better movie now than when I was young,
too. It's better. Okay. It's better than you remember.
I should rewatch.
I'd say top five King, honestly, in terms of like
it's
power.
Up there.
The funny thing is, so the complete reversal of that, you know, a film that you feel as a kid, you don't really resonate with. You're just like, oh, scary dog. Yeah. And then today you're like, oh, no, I'm a grown adult and I can actually feel that all the stuff that they're throwing into it. Pet Sematary, now as an adult, does not work as well.
Yeah. Is Zelda not scary anymore?
Those parts still are.
Zelda is still scary. It's everything else.
Yeah. And again, not the best
lead performance. Pascal is a little mishandled. I mean, like, listen. Gage is not so creepy. Like, I got into like a little argument with Ciara afterwards. She's like, what are you talking about? This movie's still scary. I'm like, I don't know. I mean, like, there's just this moment when what's his face? He's like D-ing up Gage and he's peeking his head out of the grave and the cop kind of does a sweep with his light over the cemetery and he ducks down and then he comes back up and he's got the goofiest grin on his face. Like, hey. Yeah. And yes, he's losing his mind, but the way he handled it was a little tacky. Listen, Pet Sematary is still a cool movie. I still watch it yearly, you know, during Halloween season, but, but it's starting to show its flaws. And, you know, I want nothing more than to see a remake of it now because I want to see it in really good.
Yeah.
I think Mary Lambert did a fantastic job, but with, I think, a little bit more focus, a little more skill with the spirituality and the mysticism behind it, because it all gets lost.
Well, you could push it more real too. Like that's the thing. It's pretty heightened. Like when he loses his kid, you have like big crane type shot. Like, no, that kind of, if you eliminate some of that and went grounded with the emotion, it could be really just almost don't look now-ish.
I'd say that's where it needs to go now, because if it is the, now don't go into the road, there's giant trucks here all the time. And then 2 seconds later, he gets hit by a truck.
Did you see the Dark Song movie?
I did.
Oh, see, that's
if
how
it
you
had
do.
That kind of rhythm to it, like super real, and you really want to bring back your child and that you're obsessed, that could be an interesting
thing. I think Don't Look Now is a good one to kind of reference.
Yeah, but I mean, like I said, it's a fine movie. It's just like there's a lot of warts on it over time. There's also that sequence too where after Gage's funeral, they cut to the funeral and he gets into a fight with her parents.
Oh, yeah.
And they're like, they're going full, like the father and father-in-law are going at it really head on. And every single time I see it, I think it's a dream sequence. That's just how out of place it feels.
And some of the cinematography, the blonde guy from the high school, that kid, there's some weird scenes with the blonde.
Pascal.
Yeah, there's some scenes like that where it just feel wrong or kind of over the top.
Well,
or,
and I remember when I saw the movie, it came out when I was in middle school. I saw it opening night with my dad and we were talking about it. And he had read the book. He's a big fan of the book. But he had even told me, he was like, I think the main criticism, and this always stuck with me, is like is how they handled that character because he comes across as a little bit goofy. Yeah. To me, as a kid in middle school watching this terrifying movie, Zelda, he was the guy that I was latching onto going, Zelda's fucking terrifying, but there's good ghosts out there that are going to protect me, so I'm good.
Yeah.
But now it's just like it doesn't work so well.
That's weird. I want to revisit it because I think I saw it maybe a year ago, and I still kind of dug it. Yeah. But again, it doesn't have the same lasting power as something like Cujo. Yeah. But I there's still like a lot about it.
There's a lot of iconic stuff. Really a lot of iconic stuff that works. And also Fred Gwynne is amazing. Fred Gwynne. It's hard to do a Pet Sematary movie with Fred Gwynne. But I'm sure there's somebody out there that could probably play Judd really well.
John Goodman.
there you go.
Actually, just looking at the Pet Sematary poster, you just make that. I mean, look how scary.
Hold on, turn it this way, right?
It's just such a scary image in terms of the guy with the, you know, there's just something about it. It's so intense.
Yeah, I always remember
But I don't feel
image.
Like that's the movie. You know what I mean? The film feels a little lighter.
That looks far
than
gooier and kind of
just
more
darker.
Sinister than the movie.
The movie has a glossy feel. But there was that 90s gloss to a lot of the movies.
It was the 80s.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, that whole period.
Yeah.
But during like that time, I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, no, it did. I did too.
It definitely was of its time.
All right, gang. I got to go.
What?
I got to go off to work.
Wait, you're going to miss me talking about Phoenix Forgotten?
Yes.
Oh my God.
See you next week. We'll see you next week for Slashback Video.
I'm talking Bitch That's Planet right. here.
Fine.
All right.
Turk's out.
I'm sorry.
All right.
Okay.
You'll never know what I think about Phoenix Forgotten. Yeah.
Are you guys ready for Leatherface talk?
I'm curious. Like,
I am curious as well.
It's a weird week for it. And I know we're going to be talking about that more soon.
No, obviously we lost Toby Hooper this week, and we're going to pay tribute to him a little bit later in this episode with our guest. Basically this movie, when does this come out? This comes out September 21st on DirecTV as an exclusive here in America. Mm-hmm. And then I believe later in October will be the full on release. I'll look that up in a second. But the reason I'm talking about it now is because it, just premiered at Fright Fest over in the UK. And, to be quite frank, I'm pretty surprised by the reactions that are coming out of there because, I mean, they seem to be mixed, but I'm surprised by the positive reactions.
Jerry Smith said it was the best film of the year.
And it's, Jerry, I love you, but you're crazy.
Doesn't he work for you? Don't you employ him? Hey, cut his checks.
No, I don't employ anybody at this point. I think that is crazy talk. The more I think about this movie, the more I kind of dislike it. Mm-hmm. And that's saying in terms of being a Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie or a Leatherface movie, I think it's a complete failure on that part. If it was, here's the thing, I like the filmmakers. It's the French filmmakers that did Inside, Alexandre Bustillo and Julian Mori. I like Inside. I just watched Livide, which I really liked a lot. I talked about that not too long ago. I haven't seen their third movie, but I like them as filmmakers and I like them stylistically, what they pull off. So I like the way this movie looks. There's mm-hmm. some really – it's very gory. It's very brutal, and it's got that kind of French – extremism kind of aesthetic to it while still being an American movie. And the other positives I'll give you are, acting wise, Lily Taylor is great. She is the mother of the cool. Sawyers, of that great, family. Yeah. She's always great. So she's terrific in it. And believe it or not, Stephen Dorff, who is the mm-hmm. sheriff in it, is also terrific. And so they're great, but I still dislike this movie so much. And I'll tell you why. Because it doesn't – all right. Again, non-spoilers for the audience. This is the only way I can describe it to you is that you meet the family at the very beginning, the Sawyers, in the opening sequence, which, by the way, was apparently a reshoot that had nothing to do with the original cut of the movie. You meet the family, and then an event takes place where they take away the young boy, which is Jeb. AKA destined to be Leatherface. Now, the concept on paper sounds like this could be cool, but I don't think they pulled it off in the movie. And that is that then it cuts 10 years later and there's a bunch of lunatics at an insane asylum and they all break out. And now the question is, who will be Leatherface? So it becomes a mystery.
Agatha Christie's.
It's like, all right, Leatherface. Which one of these characters will be Leatherface?
So that's terrible idea. I don't like that idea.
It is. And the reason it's terrible is because no matter what, and this is in the casting of the characters, that, like, again, maybe on a script level it works, but the reason I don't like it is because there is not a single satisfactory answer. Right. If it's the guy that looks exactly like Leatherface, then he's not part of the family. So that doesn't adhere to the rules of the original movie. If it's this other guy that they're setting up, how is that guy the guy that we meet in the original movie? So basically, they made a Leatherface movie that doesn't have Leatherface.
This also breaks the formula that the original franchise set up, which was, we know who the killers are from the get-go, but the question becomes, will they survive?
We don't need an origin. We don't need the origin. Yeah. I don't care about the story before the original Texas Chainsaw mm-hmm. Massacre, and that's why this movie is frustrating, because by the time I get to the end, where they very much try to connect it to it, I just look at it and I was like, no, I do not believe any of these characters at all are the ones that are in that classic movie.
So let me ask you, what?
And by the way, I revisited the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre the evening that Toby passed, and it made me hate this movie even more.
Of course.
That's what it did to
it. Unparalleled,
So
What's the positive coming out of England that you're hearing? Like, what is there a spin on it that you're hearing the reason people like it?
People are just like, oh, I like it. It's brutal. It's messed up. And you know, it is brutal and messed up, but, you know, because it borrows a little too much from Natural Born Killers, so it's not even that original in terms of its brutality. Again, it's like setting, and it's kind of like Texas Chainsaw 3D, where they set up on paper, this is going to continue right from the ending of the original. Mm-hmm. And then when you see that, you're like, oh man, that doesn't work at all.
Yeah.
It's like they keep doing that. There's 27 producers on this movie, and I just wish one of them knew what a Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie is, because this is not that. Now, if it wasn't Leatherface, like, let me play devil's advocate, okay? I always defend Jason Goes to Hell. Even though technically everyone yells at me and is like, yeah, but it's not a Friday 13th movie and Jason's not in it or whatever. But yes, that's fun. And here's the difference. For some reason, I feel like if you are making a sequel and taking a radical chance, it's a little bit more acceptable because it takes place after the movies and franchise you know. But if you're making a prequel with the sole intention of it explaining everything and leading up to that classic movie you love,
you might be poisoning the original movie.
Yeah.
You can't do that with a sequel.
And so I don't buy this at all. I don't buy this at all. So that's
when are Americans going to see it as a theatrical?
September. It's an exclusive to DirecTV, I believe, on September 21st.
DirecTV.
And then, which they did with The Black Coat's Daughter. Mm-hmm. That was also exclusively debuted on DirecTV first. And then October 20th is when this will come out on VOD and select theaters, I believe. October 20th is the technical official release of it. And look, I saw it with a handful of other journalists, and they all tended to agree with me. So, yeah, good luck with that one.
Okay.
Sorry.
I'm going to see it for sure.
Well, look, if you're a fan of the franchise, you have to.
Well, also and just the director is actually almost more of interest to me in the
sense. That's what I'm intrigued by because I liked their other stuff. I like how kind of graphically brutal they are, but their other films always have some type of meaning or rationalize. Yeah. The graphic nature.
Did they have a good time on this, or was this one that they left? Okay.
No.
This
and that's and on, yeah. And look, I don't know the logistics, but they introduced it at Fright Fest, and I was honestly shocked because I know for a fact a lot of this movie was reshot and changed. So I'm not sure. Maybe they showed their director's cut over there. I have
that
no
would be
idea.
Interesting, wouldn't it?
That would make sense if people are so positive about it, but this is not a movie. This is not a Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie, and it's not a Leatherface movie at all. Okay. Like if and that's what's the frustrating thing about it. So anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
Okay.
I mean, I can talk about Phoenix Forgotten.
Let's hear about Phoenix Forgotten. I can't believe you
that was a movie
Phoenix
I didn't
Forgotten.
Even know existed until I passed billboards, and then a friend of mine pointed out that it's very close. My friend was a close friend of mine as the DP, the same guy who shot The Frontier, Jay Cattell, and he shot my last short. So I was kind of surprised. So I had been waiting for it to be free. good friend of mine. Good
I'm sorry,
mine.
I just looked this up, and I know exactly. It's the found footage UFO.
UFO, one, yeah. And I was the same where I did not know it existed until I saw a
They're
billboard.
Big posters, yeah.
Yeah, billboard near my house, and then I was like, I hadn't even paid attention to the billboard.
Ridley
and then I was
Scott
like,
produced it.
Oh, okay.
Yes, yeah. This I posted about this on the website on Blumhouse.com a while back.
This is a very good. It's a funny one. It's very well put together. It's not as cheap feeling as your average found footage. It's shot really well. It's shot consistently well because it's not just all the rough footage. It's also documental footage, trying to find the footage, trying to find somebody's missing brother. The problem with the film, again, is basically what you would expect, which is it feels like it's 10 or 12 years too late. Like it feels like 10 or 12 years earlier, I would have just taken it on and gone, oh, that was cool. Instead, I'm just watching it. Oh, it's well put together, and it's got a couple nice surprising moments with alien lights. It's basically a kid who, on his sister's birthday, and it's all VHS camera footage from the 80s, they see some major lights in the sky, and then he kind of becomes obsessed to follow it with some documentary footage. And then in the present story, him and his two friends obviously went missing in the past. So it's his older sister trying to make a documentary about what happened to my brother. It's never been answered. And those two stories kind of go, you know, at the same time. It doesn't really go somewhere that's fully satisfying by the end, but there are some, if you like those kind of movies, and I don't mean found footage, I mean alien abductions, it's decent. It really isn't a bad movie at all. And I'm not just saying that. It really is well put together. It's just, it's too late. It's too late for, unless you're going to make a found footage film that's going to now turn it on its head in the way Cabin in the Woods or something would do with found footage, it's too late for that kind of movie.
Yeah.
Because we've just been wired and desensitized to that format, in my opinion. So it's okay. It's not that scary. It's got a couple good surprising effects. I love found footage films when they are able to put it's cheap, and then you can tell they put all this money into like one moment or one visual gag, which is usually kind of an exciting thing.
Yeah.
I had a couple of those. But it's definitely not must-see, but I do think people like the alien abduction might get into it.
I'm confused by their marketing because one, I knew nothing about this. Like, and I mean, and you know, this was back when Rob and I were completely submerged in this all the time. And like, I don't even remember getting a lot of press releases.
Yeah, it seemed
about
like it just popped up.
It just kind of popped up. I remember seeing the billboard outside my house and being, oh, what's that? But even the poster didn't really make it look hard. It just looked like staticky video footage of a girl. And so, like, I didn't even pay that much attention to it. So I feel like their marketing may have been a tad off from what I think would have actually been kind of eye-catching.
It's definitely not bad. It's one of the – because I usually, you know, I'm probably like 8 out of 10 I can't stand. This one, I was watching it interested the whole way. I was never bored, but I feel like it would have had to go somewhere really surprising and original at the end for me to really go, wow, what a great movie. Mm. Instead, it's just like, it's another found footage film that's okay.
And you said it is free now. Where can we see it?
It's free. I think maybe it's coming to Netflix. I think I saw it on Vudu or something. So maybe it's not free yet. I saw it on Vudu. So
Phoenix Rising?
Phoenix Forgotten.
Forgotten.
How ironic.
Phoenix Forgotten.
That's
and
funny.
I forgot already.
Yeah.
Beck, anything else from you?
Yeah. So I rewatched The Battery.
Hey.
Which I'm as I mentioned last week, I'm teaching a couple classes at USC, and this past week I was teaching a lesson, which I wish somebody had taught to me when I was in film school, how to make a feature for super cheap. And so I was talking about features that are made for, you know, less than 10,000 or even less than 50,000, and was talking about some of them and showing them different techniques and how to approach and what to do and what not to do and, you know, avoid a whole bunch of locations. This isn't the time you cast your 100 friends type thing. And so I showed a lot of clips from The Battery, and my students really responded to it. So we ended up watching the whole thing. And once I started watching it again, it's so good.
Yeah.
And then I remembered that we had talked about this a lot years ago on Killer POV, and I felt that I just needed to say again, if you guys have not seen The Battery, you need to see it. It's just a really great example of how talent will shine through any budget level, no matter what.
Yeah, this was Jeremy Gardner who starred in it and Ron directed it with a small crew for like $6,000.
Yeah.
And it's funny because you mentioned it, the stupid time hop thing or whatever on this day on Facebook. It's about 2 years since it came out through Scream Factory on Blu-ray. Mm-hmm. And we were kind of pivotal in making that happen.
Yeah, because even that, the film had come out probably 8 months prior to that. And
kind of like their own VOD. They were selling it themselves as a video download. But yeah, from talking about it, it was actually Killer POV episode 43 is when we had Jeremy on, which is worth going back to check out again. But yeah, it still holds up. And we did a great screening at your cafe, Jump Cut. Yeah. Which was
2 years today.
2 years,
which means also 2 years today that Wes Craven died.
I know. Oh my
God. we have double things to be discussing. It's kind of crazy. But 2 years, I got to say, for me, this last 2 years feels like it's been a lot of things have happened.
Oh my God!
Like, you know what I mean? It feels almost more like five.
Yeah. We're living life.
We had a show called Killer POV.
Yeah, remember that?
2 years ago, we all had different jobs. We literally, none of us had the same jobs.
You're right.
I had a fucking cafe. A lot's happened in 2 years.
I think Elric and I were short kids then.
Yeah. Well, you were. We're I one, had like a very small one.
There was one each, I think.
Yeah, one each.
Keaton helped in destroying my... Having the second one definitely didn't help.
He may listen to this one day.
He will be. But anyway, it's kind of crazy how 2 years can really... Change. A lot of stuff can happen.
Yeah.
In short periods. So, but you know, it's it was just interesting because I do remember that's a memory I remember because AJ Bowen was really sick, but he showed up to do the intro anyway. And so I always remember that was pretty cool.
Super cool.
But it was a great screening. I think that film benefits a lot by the very thing that it didn't probably get at all, which is being on a screen. I loved it when I saw it on TV, but it was twice the thing when I saw it in captive crowd.
I saw it twice that way, and the audience was always won over every time. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, no, and he's really smart. I mean, that last sequence, we won't give spoilers, but there's a long sequence all played out through in a car, and you're just like, that's really, when you're talking about independent production, it's like so smart, and yet it works so well.
Yeah, and you know? One of my students pointed this out to me, the scene where Jeremy, who plays one of the main characters, is dancing and getting drunk by himself.
Yeah.
One of my students was like, the camera gets drunk too. And I was like, what do you mean? And when we took it back and rewatched it, gradually it gets more and more out of focus.
And shaking.
Very slowly throughout the whole scene. So that you don't really notice that much. But then as soon as he pointed out, I was like, oh my God, it does.
The DP was taking shots with him.
Probably. Christian Stellar. He did a great job on that too.
Well, I think the biggest tragedy is that we haven't had a real Jeremy horror follow-up. I know he's done other stuff, but I know he's got lots of stuff burning.
Well, The Battery's great. He did a little comedy with the same crew called Texas Montana Will Survive.
Yeah.
I think that's the name of it. Which is on YouTube.
He gave it out for free.
You can actually watch on YouTube. And it's fun. It's actually funnier on the second viewing.
Yeah.
But I think he might have just wrapped a new horror movie.
Oh, okay.
Nice.
I'm pretty sure he did. And he's been acting in a lot of stuff. He's in The Mind's Eye, Joe Bigos' movie. And I think he did a movie with Mickey.
He appears in Spring briefly.
He's got my favorite line in Spring.
Oh, he's great in Spring.
Don't make me sleep in your dead mom's bed.
I love that line. I think that's like one of my favorite written lines of that year. It's great.
Yeah. So he's around, and I do hope we get to see more from him as a writer-director. But all right. Is that everything?
I will say quickly because it's not quite horror. Because
here it comes,
I've been
Elric. Are you
taking
ready? Brace yourself. Go ahead.
Bitch Planet.
What?
Bitch Planet. Oh my God. So we talked about this one briefly before when we had Ivanka on a couple of months ago. One of the questions that we asked was like, what's inspiring you right now? And she was like, Bitch Planet. And at the time I had only read the very first one. And this is a comic book.
That's right. Yeah.
And so I'd only read the very first one. And a couple of days ago, I'm at the library in Burbank and they have like a shelf of all of these adult graphic novels. Mm-hmm. And there's volume 1 and 2 of Bitch Planet. And I'm like, okay. library, free, I'm in. And so I checked them both out and read the whole thing in one day. It's absolutely amazing. And so I can't recommend this graphic novel enough. It is about a very kind of futuristic society, but not that futuristic, I'll say, where women who get too kind of wily, who either go against men or go against society, or even just morbid obesity, drug addiction, being too sexual, there's like all these different crimes in it, are sent to a prison planet, which they have an actual name for, but everybody nicknamed it Bitch Planet. And then some of them are forced to play in these like Running Man-esque games. And it's awesome.
You know, it's got a shade of that that we haven't really talked about, because even though it's come out now, is The Bad Batch by Lilian Vapour has shades of it. It just opens with a girl, teenage girl, just being expelled out into some weird middle of nowhere desert as part of like a prison system. But she's a very modern girl. And then you start realizing there's cannibals. There are all sorts of crazy people out there. But it's not exactly the same kind of prison thing, but it's of that ilk. But yeah. I haven't heard many people talking about it yet.
Yeah. I think it's finally out.
Yeah.
Okay. I remember it played at Beyond.
Yeah.
It didn't seem to get a
big, I mean, it's a very eccentric film.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not as A to B as her first film, which on paper should be eccentric, but really works in as a fluid, tight little piece. You know, this is really like kind of a crazy vision. It has some great stuff, but doesn't all necessarily kind of work to me.
I will definitely check it out. But yeah, check out Bitch Planet, especially because we're coming off of our exploitation month. The whole thing is written like an exploitation film. Like really does feel like, an exploitation
Jack Hill
movie.
Prison movie.
A lot of it takes place in a shower, and at the top it will always say like shower scene or necessary shower scene and things like that. So they really do play it as if it's an exploitation movie, but at the same time it's very kind of anti. So yeah, it's a really fascinating read. So,
okay, cool.
Bitch Planet.
Very cool. Alrighty, well, let's hear from our sponsor and we will be right back.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Shudder. Brought to you by AMC Network, Shudder is not only a premium streaming video service, but an experience unlike any other. Created for fans of all degrees of thriller, suspense, and horror, Shudder is home to the largest and fastest-growing human-curated selection of high-quality, spine-tingling, and provocative films, TV series and originals, and there's always something new and unexpected for Shudder members to explore.
New this week, Neil Gaiman's Likely Stories, adapted from the dark tales of author Neil Gaiman. This collection of distinct, odd, and brilliant short stories is both cinematic and strange. In each film, each character is compelled to share their story, and we're drawn into their very act of telling tall tales. While each episode has its own lead character, they are backed by an ensemble cast that play across all four bold and original films. If you enjoyed American Gods, Coraline, or Stardust, you'll love Neil Gaiman's Likely Stories.
Shudder is available for $4.99 a month or $49.99 with an annual membership. But our listeners can get a free month by entering promo code SHOCK at checkout. That is SHOCK at checkout.
Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of thrillers, suspense, and horror available to stream anywhere.
We are back with a friend of ours who everyone here has known for a whole lot of time.
Yep. He co-hosts Horror Trivia with me.
Yep. And he was easily the best player in the history of Horror Trivia when it was at Jump Cut.
Which is why he now hosts with
That's
me.
Yeah.
He was skewing the points, so yeah. I had to pull him out.
And that is Jared Rivett. Welcome
Hello.
To the show.
Thank you. It is an amazing honor to be here.
And just last night, as I
Episode
tweeted.
Episode 11 of Killer POV.
And last night I was standing a few feet away from Cecil B. Demented, which is what I tweeted. I was very excited, and I was only standing that close to him because of you, because we were at the premiere of Jackals, which a lot of people I had not followed at all, so I didn't even see the trailer before, which was definitely a good way to go in for me, because I you know, everyone otherwise people see masks and they go, "Oh, it's your next, it's strangers." But it was nice to go in and not have that initially. The cool thing for our listeners about this movie, that probably the way a lot of you will hear about it, is because it's also Scream Factory.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Putting it out.
That's right.
And we searched Jeff Nelson there last night too. So on, and I was saying to you, like on, and this is because I, you know, with friends stuff, it's always, you do have to be honest in my opinion.
Yes.
And I know you would see through it if we weren't.
Yes. I would
so surprised. Well, for one, it's a brutal, ugly, and it moves fast. Mm-hmm. So one of the easy things to criticize with movies like this are when they drag or have kind of bad acting.
Right.
This film is very tight. I don't know what the running time exactly is.
It's 86 minutes.
86 minutes. And it has that kind of feel. There's no fat to this. You can tell Kevin, the director, who also edited a lot of the Saw films, all of them.
All of them.
All the Saw films. And directed the last
six.
Couple.
Yeah, six and seven.
That's right.
Yeah. And
yeah,
you just get that
lot.
Feel. I like this the direction in those a lot more than his last couple of Saw films. I think it's a lot more taut and just kind of like you kind of you feel a bit more. But it's a really tight, it's very much a throwback to 80s. But also it's got like a lot of ambiguity in it, which is not something you often get in those kind of movies. Usually you get just, all right, this is A to B, this is what's happening. I came out talking to you like, oh, so is it this or is it this?
Right.
And I was kind of surprised that I had to have that many questions, and not in a bad way, in a way that I feel like maybe it's kind of open to interpretation, which is kind of fun. So I had a good time watching this, and I really think that a certain kind of horror fan is going to like this a lot because, and I think you said at one point you think it's going to be kind of polarizing potentially.
It already is. I mean, the reviews, it's definitely like 50-50. There are great positive reviews. Mm-hmm. People that like it seem to love it. And today I read a review that was zero stars and they hated it.
Yeah.
Hated it. It was like the worst thing they'd seen all year and they couldn't believe how bad it was. And I was called out specifically as being responsible.
Oh!
So like repeatedly. Like this person really did not like, and it was...
Are you sure you just didn't piss this person off?
Yeah, probably.
At some point?
Who knows? Who knows? I didn't recognize the name. I don't know who it was.
All right. Just lay off Bowsman.
Yeah.
All right. Give him a break.
It is
50-50.
And I kind of expected it to be 50-50. Yeah. I think at some point. And I mean, this is my first produced feature.
Yeah. And I think part of it's when you wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
So you wrote it before Your Next. You wrote it before The Strangers came out. But you wrote it. It does feel, when I say throwback, I think a lot of people think, and I mean to the 80s where it's set. It's not. The tone is more of the just after Hostel movies. It's still in that.
Yes.
It's not completely torture porny because there's not a lot of the torture part.
No.
But it does feel like that.
Yeah.
And that's when you wrote it?
Yeah. I actually wrote the script in 2006.
Wow. Welcome
to
Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah.
10 years, a mere 10 years.
And it was, we shot it in 2015. So it was 9 years when it was like moving forward and happening. And then 10 while it was in post and getting sold and all that stuff. And now we're into year 11.
I think we start with congratulations.
Thank you.
Just to stick with things in this world.
Thank you.
Now it's a real movie on a real screen.
Yeah.
You saw people. You had the door. Steven Dorff.
It was there. It was unbelievable. And Jonathan Scheck. I wrote it in 2006. And it was something that got a lot of attention. It was originally called Sacrilege. And a lot of people were attached to direct it. For some reason, it just got a lot of attention.
When you came on Killer POV, wasn't it when Bowsman and you guys were talking about it? Or was that a different thing?
No. Bowsman came on and talked about it when he was attached. But that was after I came on as a fill-in with Brian Collins because you were out.
Yeah, because we were doing a slasher.
And that makes sense that you'd need two of you to make up one of me.
Yeah.
I like these stats.
But it was
two of the best horror minds we know, Collins and Jared, to make up
one. Podcast host.
And it's great because if you go back and listen to it, Becca has no idea who I am.
None.
At all.
Probably.
Oh, so this was the early days where you
guys
Yes.
Oh, man, I wish we could insert a little part of that right in
it's
the middle.
It's fascinating. No. It's utterly fascinating. She has no idea
because now I think of you two as knowing each other so well.
I know. No, because Jared and I, like, now we've been co-hosting trivia together for a really long time.
Like, 2 years almost.
Yeah. Since Jump Cut Ended.
Since Jump Cut Ended. Yeah.
Wow. Weird, man.
So that's, so we've been doing that. And Elric and I, you know, from Jump Cut, we go way back. And Rob and I go way back. And Rob used to be on my
trivia team.
Yeah,
that's right.
If Ryan were here, Ryan and I've known Ryan longer. I think I've known Ryan longer than anybody else in LA has known Ryan. I've known Ryan since the early 2000s.
Where did you guys work? Was it like
We worked at a place called the Transcription Company.
Oh my God.
And it was a place in Burbank that just did showbiz transcripts. Uh-huh. So.
Just raw. Typing? Were you typing it?
I wasn't typing it. Ryan and I were both administrative. We both kind of handled a lot of the front end and back end stuff of that job. But that's actually where the idea for Jackals actually appeared. Ryan was in the room when I got the idea.
Oh, weird.
He was here. I'm kind of bummed.
He hasn't seen it yet, right?
He saw a very early cut.
Okay.
But he hasn't seen the final. Well, I don't know. I shouldn't say he hasn't seen it. To my knowledge, he hasn't seen the final cut. He saw a very, very early. I think he saw like the first assembled edit.
He's an insider now, so he could have seen
it. We don't know. Yes, he sees that's all the just it. Stuff. I actually don't know. I actually don't know. I haven't been in touch with him about
he's
it.
He's at a secret screening right now.
Yeah. But he was God there because the, basically the whole kind of premise of, you know, Jackals is it's a cult deprogrammer is hired by a family. It's the 1980s, the early 1980s. They hire a culty programmer to kidnap their son out of what is – it was supposed to be a satanic cult, but we toned that down. It's just kind of a – it's a they don't really give you any real
you
sense of what their deal is. But they're a very dangerous, homicidal cult, and they take him to a cabin, the family cabin in the woods, and they're going through the deprogramming, which is all very arduous and very dramatic and very heavy, and it's breaking their hearts, and he's this monster. He's this thing that they don't even recognize in terms of personality. And while all that's going on, the cult shows up outside and they want him back.
Yeah.
And the idea for that whole thing came, I wanted to do a satanic ritual abuse thing, and I didn't know how to approach it. It was like, well, if I do satanic ritual abuse, it's going to be NC-17. The script is going to be something where it's just going to be nasty, awful. So all my research was like the stuff that was – and again, there was never any evidence that any of this stuff ever really happened.
But all the stuff from like the original books was all very,
very
sexual
intense. Yeah,
it's just
stuff that you
shit.
Could never ever put – it would be like doing Naked Lunch like straight, like just doing a straight adaptation of Naked Lunch. Yeah. So it was always like, well, I can't really do this. Like it's not something that's practical or anything that anybody's ever going to buy. And so I was at work in the office with Ryan – when a transcript came through, it was an old cult deprogrammer, like a retired cult deprogrammer. And cult deprogramming was also something from the 80s that is not a thing anymore, primarily because it was basically highly illegal and the guys doing it didn't have to have any real credentials. And so they were just these – I've been referring to them lately as psychological bounty hunters basically because they had to be kind of bounty hunter psychologists. You had to basically kidnap somebody and then undo the brainwashing. So they would deprogram.
What's the Mary Elizabeth Winstead dead one from like 2 years
ago? False.
False is good.
Really
yes,
good.
One
really
of my
good.
Favorites is Holy Smoke, but it's a comedy version of what we're talking about. Like with Harvey Keitel is the greatest deprogrammer.
Yeah.
He's just hilarious.
Yeah, well, and then the two that were really a big influence on me, one – God, I can't think of the damn name of it. But the other one is the main one, the one that I was really, really paying attention to was this movie from 1982 called Split Image.
Yeah, I remember the cover. I don't know if I saw that.
It looks like a horror film on the cover, but it's not. Yeah. It's actually a drama. It's like it's kind of a thriller. But it's directed by Ted Kochev, who did First
Ted
Blood.
Kochev. So that's probably why I remember.
Yeah, and it's the same year as First Blood.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and Waking Friday.
Brian Dennehy and James Woods and Karen Allen from Raiders of the Lost Ark and all these great – like the cast is amazing. Nobody's seen this movie. Huh. Peter Fonda plays the cult leader. And they're kind of
great.
A hippy dippy, you know,
perfect for him.
Right. Oh yeah. It's all about peace and love. And like, they totally brainwashed this kid. He's like a Olympic gymnast, hopeful. And he disappears one day and they find out he's staying at this compound. And so they hire James Woods to kidnap him out of the cult.
Oh my gosh.
You
got to
see it. You
got to
see it. I think it's on Amazon. It might be on Amazon.
I think that's our pick for the week.
It's a really good movie. Huh. And it's like my favorite culty, but it's like the culty programming drama.
Right. I'll tell you one thing that, and it's a shame now because if you're listening to this too late, a lot of you probably saw the trailer, not knowing that that was what the movie was about.
Oh, sorry.
No, but that's fine. I mean, you're the writer.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that much.
Right.
And so when I went into it, I have to say it was a good 20 minutes into this movie
before I knew that was,
and when it happened, I was surprised in the room. I was like, oh, I thought this was just going to be a family, you know, people are going to attack a house and torture a family.
Yeah. So, I thought it was just straight up siege.
Yeah. So because I didn't see a trailer, I wasn't ready. And even if you wouldn't know anything from the first 15 minutes that's where it's going, that it was a nice surprise to have. So it's too late if you're listening now, but if you can reverse time. but it was a good surprise in that way because I guess so many films are just that.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. So I had the culty programming transcript, this dude that used to do culty programming, and he talked about how they couldn't do it anymore because they were getting brought up on charges of kidnapping and all this other stuff because people that they would take to get deprogrammed would then go to the cops. Like they would pretend to go along with it or they would go back to the cult or they would kind of, you know, realize like, no, wait, this is messed up. Like I didn't want this. I'm an adult. I made a choice, you know, and so they would go to the cops and they would get arrested. So it just became untenable as a thing. So now we have interventions and that kind of stuff. But at the time it was this really interesting practice. So I'm reading this And for some reason, it just hit me, lightning bolt. And I turned to Ryan and I said, has there ever been a satanic cult movie like The Devil's Reign or Race with the Devil or any of those kinds of movies where there's like a cult deprogrammer who grabs one of them and is going to try to like undo it?
Mm-hmm.
And Ryan was like, his eyes went wide. He said, no, I don't, not that I can think of. And I said, me either. I think I'm going to go write it.
Cool.
And so,
oh man, that's such a bummer. He's not here.
Yeah. I know. It's amazing.
It feels so full
I'm
circle.
Turk so
was
bummed.
There for your brain baby.
He was there for the brain baby.
But it's kind of cool that you're sitting in the seat he was sitting in 5 minutes
yeah.
ago. So that's almost as good.
But basically, the first director that was attached to direct it was Toby Hooper.
Yeah. Wow.
Oh man.
So yeah. He would have directed. It was then called Sacrilege. He would have directed it, and instead, he died the week that it's coming out for theaters.
Oh my God.
Directed by Kevin Greuter.
Well, we do. I definitely want. We're going to do a Toby Hooper tribute a little bit later in this episode,
yeah.
And I definitely want to hear about how he got involved,
sure.
and what happened. But before any of that, let's talk a little bit about the relationship with Scream Factory.
Sure.
Because they're good friends of ours. They've been on
yeah.
several times, and I think it's very exciting that obviously they put a lot of effort into kind of preserving and restoring and doing excellent work with old classic titles.
Yeah. Right.
And I think it was very exciting when they announced to us that they were going to do Fender Bender, Mark Pavey's movie. So, so how did they get involved in this, the movie that got made, Jackals?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what was kind of, how are they different from the average studio in terms of working with them?
Good questions. First of all, it was an incredible coincidence. Now I go to Scream Factory once a month to pick up prizes for Dead Right Horror Trivia.
Yes.
Oh, that's right.
Every third
they
Thursday,
are
Jared
not far
goes to them.
From 20th Century Fox, where I call home. And so once a month I go over there and I hang out with Jeff Nelson. We do lunch and we talk and he gives me prizes and some, any kind of, hey, do you want to look at this? Can you tweet about that? And I'll watch it and I'll put something up. And so he gives me stuff. So I had the whole time Jackals was, when I first started doing trivia, Jackals was just about to be shot.
Yeah, you got, because I remember you were thinking that you may have to miss a couple
yeah,
of days.
And then I didn't. So we shot it in December and so the whole time that I've been going to Scream Factory, the movie has basically been either in production or in post-production or whatever. And the movie was done. And I didn't want to cross that line. I didn't want to say to them, hey, guys, I've got this little indie movie. But the producer was shopping it around, and he was doing his thing. I actually was not being kept abreast of what he was doing with the movie. And then one day in March of this year, Jeff Nelson texted me and said, you'll never guess what I'm watching right now. And I was like, is it some exciting movie that they're going to get? Is it like Hell Night that everybody is hoping that they're going to release? Yeah. Or any of this stuff? And I said, what, Jeff? And he said, Jackals. I said, really? He said, yeah, my people have already watched it and love it and want to put it out. And they want to see what I think.
Wow.
And I was like, are you really? Like, this is for real. He's like, why didn't you tell me that you wrote this movie? I said, I just didn't want to like mix the two things. I didn't want to, they're doing this. I mean, look, they are so generous. They are so amazing with us when it comes to trivia that I just, it's like, well, don't mess with that.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's a real, don't eat where you shit,
Yeah.
So I didn't want to make it awkward. I didn't want to mix the two things. They've been always so great to us. They sponsored a night recently.
Yeah,
they gave
always
us all their prizing. All of our questions were about Scream Factory. So how was it to work with them? They are so invested in the material, so invested in what they like. That they love horror movies and they legitimately love horror movies. And I think that is the first big difference between them and, I wouldn't name any names, but other kind of mini majors or studios or whatever, where they don't really care. They just want to know demographically, like who it's going to appeal to and what market it's going to hit and how much it's going to make. And Scream Factory was just like, we love this movie. We're going to get behind this. And I have to say, like, for the last 2 months, they've been like nonstop with the daily and weekly, just, they'll put up different, a still with a blurb and, with dates. And we came up with a contest. Jeff is doing a contest that's based on my Jackal's thing that I did at trivia, which was
I picked cult movies.
I picked, you know, kind of horror movies, you know, stuff that was cult and stuff that was also kind of related. So like Prince of Darkness and some other stuff that I thought was kind of similar in tone, or that had, like, I even had Ghoulies in there because Ghoulies has the Satanist.
It's technically Satanist. A cult.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, it's first and foremost, it's kind of a cult movie, a Satanist
but
movie.
But the guy who won the competition was Jacob Davison. So he was at the premiere, and I just thought Jared had invited him, because he's always at trivia. This is the guy's always at trivia.
Right, right.
Yeah,
no.
And then he's like, yeah, I won the competition. And it was I'm like, what?
Completely coincidence. Everything with this movie, everything with the situation it's has weird. Been a strange, strange coincidence. But they've been so, so great, and they've been doing so much extra. Was just bending over backwards, and I was talking to God. Can I say this? I don't know. Patrick Melton today, and they had a film that he and Marcus had a film that came out last year called The Neighbor.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't get to see that one yet. With the girl from Starry.
There's a reason we haven't seen it. It's because the company that put it out evidently has not done a whole lot of legwork with it. They haven't really backed it or pushed it in any real way. Patrick came to guest at trivia, and I actually said the soon to be released The Neighbor, and he leaned over to the microphone and said, actually, it came out last week. And I had no idea.
Oh,
and
man.
So he called me today, and he was like, they're really doing a good job. He said, I've seen all of this stuff. Every couple of days they're putting something up. Like, you know, they may not have the means, they may not have the billboard TV spot, you know, kind of money or influence, but they care, and it's grassroots, and they're putting it out there. And you know, it's a small, small movie that they picked up, but it was a total coincidence. The producer submitted it to them, and they liked it and decided that they wanted to do it. So it's acquisition.
They're so hands-on. At one point, Jeff Nelson pulled me into a corner and said, I'll give you Serial Mom for 2 tweets. just two, and you get Serial Mom.
Elric, that's not true.
That's not true. Jeff would never do that.
Jeff would never do that.
Because Jeff's so nice, he gave me Serial Mom for free.
Yes.
And then you tweeted about it.
He didn't even ask for anything. That's right.
Jeff did a whole episode of Pure Cinema about Serial Mom, right?
Yeah.
Well, let's just mention The Neighbor really quick, because it is available for rental already on Amazon.
There you go.
I actually want to watch it now. You've made me want to watch it.
Because I really like Marcus Stunson as a director.
Did you know
the collector movies? This is the first time I've even heard of this movie.
See?
And that is a sin from the guys that wrote 4 Saw movies.
Yep.
And
yeah.
You don't know their new movies.
Is this the one with the girl from Star Wars?
I don't know.
I'm looking it up right now.
Alex, she's like a lead, and I'd watch her in anything.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
That is offense to whoever distributed this, but that's a crime that none of us on this show that hosted even know of this thing's existence.
Yeah.
So check it out.
So now I am going to check out The Neighbor.
Who is the distribution company?
Let's not do that. Let's not go there.
Probably one of our former guests.
But he was comparing their kind of tactics with Scream Factories, and he was basically saying it's night and day, and that I can consider myself very, very.
Yes,
and
this is a big release for Scream in terms of the ones they've got involved in. This is a big deal. Jeff said this was the biggest event he had been to.
We had a full-blown premiere last night with red carpet and flash bulbs, and they got microphones and cameras in my face.
And Brad Dourif.
And Brad, no, not
oh,
Brad,
sorry.
Steve Indorf.
Sorry,
Steve
Indorf.
and I turned to somebody and I was
Steve
just like,
Indorf.
You look at the people and they look different than real life.
Yes.
The kind of people who go to these kind of premieres literally look like they don't exist. They exist in a bubble and only come out for special.
Well,
like their skin's gray.
Yes. Well, Jonathan.
The dresses most people couldn't fit into. It's like a crazy
Jonathan
thing.
Jonathan Scheck.
Seriously,
I mean, like that guy's body is something.
Yeah. Oh,
like,
was this one of those red carpets where like actresses who aren't even in the movie come and do the red carpet?
Yes.
And you're like, who are these people and how are they still standing? They're so vertical.
Yes.
That was the kind of party.
I've been to parties like that where I'm like, I don't know how these people are walking. That's amazing. Okay.
Yeah. That was definitely a 50-50 kind of thing with Scream Factory and my producer, Tommy Alastra. Tommy's very, very good at throwing parties.
Yeah.
I mean, he's that kind of guy.
Hey,
so I knew it was going to be a big day. Whoever distributed the movie, I knew that when we had the big premiere, and I'm doing air quotes with my fingers right now, that it was going to be a big, crazy, ridiculous Hollywood thing. And so my first produced feature is getting a small theatrical release. And I went to the Chinese to have a ridiculous, you know, event, premiere event.
That's epic.
And again, just to reiterate, this script is 10 years old.
10 years old.
But you've been writing a lot of stuff and come
yes.
this close. Yes. I have a little tiny fraction in my in-between. Yes. This close to so many things. So yes. it's kind of like finally richly deserved. Like just to, just so anybody doesn't think like, oh, he's like wrote a thing and collected trivia and it's now. You've been pounding the pavement for many years.
Yes. And I was listening to NPR on the way here, which might be the lamest thing I've ever said. Uh-huh. But I was listening
and you
to
you say a lot of like,
I do.
And there was
Shut
an interview
up,
with
like
and there was
Sandra
an interview
Bullock.
With Sandra Bullock.
yeah, exactly. Like Sandra
do you
Bullock.
Guys realize when I said that I was dissing Sandra Bullock? No, I was talking about how bad Hope Float sucks.
And Ryan ran to the defense.
And Ryan ran to the defense of Sandra Bullock, guys.
And the Hope Falls fans came out of nowhere.
Yeah, the Hope Float.
Hope Float. Whatever, same difference.
I was talking about how bad it sucks. Anyway, I was listening to NPR on the way here, and they were talking – it was this kind of diatribe that was very critical of Variety. Mm. And it was talking about how the majority – and it was like the gross majority of films that get announced in Variety, like, you know, this is happening, and we've attached this person. The gross majority never happened.
Never happened. No, it's true. It's
and
true.
Yeah. So they just yeah. they just disappear into the ether.
Well, I mean, you guys talked about when Darren was on.
Oh, yeah.
Sacrilege was – announced everywhere mm-hmm. as being the next thing he was doing before Abattoir.
Wow.
And he came on your guys' show and he talked about it. And he was
Abattoir's been out for like a year now.
Yeah. And it was funny because Abattoir kind of in a mostly direct way was the reason that he didn't end up doing Jackals, really.
Yeah. Wow.
Because he went off to kind of do that and Jackals kind of started to
times,
it fell apart. That's the thing. It kept happening.
Different casts.
Right. That was nuts. And I was there for all of that because we were working on Jackals. And so it was almost like whichever one goes first. And then Abattoir went first and Jackal started to go too. And it was like, well, I'm, you know, what do you want me to do? And it's like, okay, just never mind.
I also love the idea like of a 10-year-old script. What, and every director, Toby, Darren, mm-hmm. Kevin, probably a couple more.
There's more people.
Every single one of them would have made a completely different movie.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting to think what that would be.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you had to do rewrites for each
yes.
director.
Yeah. Yeah. Toby, you know? What's funny is Toby and I had a conversation once where he said that he would love to do a simultaneous production of the same script from two different directors. Yeah. And it was something he thought was like, it'd just be a cool, because like we were talking, I think we were talking about like the Dominion and Exorcist the Beginning.
Oh, yeah,
or something.
He
was like, yeah, but wouldn't it be interesting to do that on purpose? Wouldn't it be interesting to just
That's a really cool idea.
Finance two movies yeah. and not communicate and don't you know,
That's
so Scorsese
script.
And Spielberg are given the same script mm-hmm. and don't talk to each other for a year. And go off and make the film, and then we see what they come up with.
Yeah. So somebody had thrown that idea to me a couple of years ago, so I'm sure it didn't happen. But mm-hmm. it was an anthology film where the same short film is presented to four different directors. No communication, nothing.
They it, yeah.
And they all four just make the script.
I think Drew
Daywald
at one point released a script to be done like that.
Maybe that's what it was.
He did bring that up.
I think that's what I'm thinking of.
And he brought it up on either Killer POV or on Rush Jacket.
I remember that because at that point I was helping Drew do the producing some of the shorts. And he had released a script that he never made.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that's right.
And
that's
basically was like, go and make it. I'm giving you all permission to make it.
Right.
I don't know whatever came of that.
I remember that.
Yeah,
I would like to see what everybody would come up with.
Yeah,
it would be totally different.
But so it's interesting when you bring up all the different directors because, I mean, it really is. I mean, if I had to go through, Stephen C. Miller was on. It was, like, officially on it at one point.
Oh, wow.
Toby, Marcus Dunstan kind of came in at one point, but it wasn't, like, as serious. We were working on another project, and Sacrilege was falling apart and with a whole different situation. And so Marcus kind of, being Marcus, came in and was like, I'm going to, whatever I can do, anything I can do. So he kind of came on as a director for a few weeks and then it was like, no, it's okay. We got this covered. Everything's fine. Mm. But then Darren was on it and then we ended up with Kevin. But the years in between, I mean, the interesting thing about the first draft of the script is that the first version of the script had this huge third act, huge, big budget busting third act. And Toby initially was like, you know, dude, you gotta get rid of that third act. Like he really was like, it's just like it's set in a cabin. And so everybody kind of looked at the first like 27 pages and was like, this is economical, this is intense, it's you know, this is something that we can do, it's all contained. And then you get to page 28 and it turns into this big gigantic thing. And it was just I was too young, I guess, to really understand that what I really needed to do was like cut that out of the script. Yeah. Oh, Dan Farren's wanted to direct it at one point as well. And actually, it was Dan Farren's that kind of was like, it was his was like the fifth or sixth or seventh time that it had fallen apart. And it was with Dan, it was because they had a certain amount of money. And he was like, okay, look, like, I can't do this script justice. And he was really cool about it. He was like, I just don't think I'm going to do it justice with the amount of money that we have. But he really wanted to do it. And it was a real bummer. And that was the year that I went home and told my then wife that I was going to spend Christmas break cutting the third act and rewriting the script so that it ended, began and ended at the cabin.
And that's also when he rewatched Cruising and decided I need even more leather in my movie.
Yes.
Leather and Cruising. Because there is a lot of guys in leather.
Yes.
I mean, big masks.
Yes.
So it's leather.
Right.
But that came later.
Yes. Yeah. So no, but it was an interesting long journey, and there were different people that came and went, and it was a very, very interesting kind of depressing.
Yeah.
Exciting, you know, you would think it was going to happen and then it wouldn't. And like Rob said, I mean, I've written over 40 feature scripts.
Yeah. Wow.
So.
And also it was weird that it's one of the older ones to get made now because you've probably changed or moved on from it in some ways.
Yes.
And so that must be a weird feeling.
Well, and then the thing about that one, like some scripts just go away. Some scripts you write them and they're just okay, or they didn't quite spark with anybody and they kind of disappear. They fizzle out and they go away. And then you have, there's like usually a handful. For me, there's only like a handful. I really only have like four of these that don't go away.
Yeah.
And people keep calling about them and you keep getting emails about them and people keep checking in on them. Yeah. And occasionally something looks like it's going to happen. And it's like, okay, it's really exciting. Like maybe this is going to happen. And then it doesn't happen. So the thing about those is that you often end up working on them, later. You go back to them and do, so people give you notes.
Right.
And they become this kind of weird little world that you find yourself that's like, oh yeah, I get to go back and be in the cabin with the folks from Sacrilege. And so it really did start to feel that way. And I think it was interesting to kind of finally be on set and see actors playing these scenes. There was a scene in Jackals that we shot that had remained virtually unchanged from when I originally wrote it. It was a big dramatic scene. And when we were done shooting it, Kevin looked at me and I was kind of choked up. And he's like, you okay? And I said, I've been waiting 10 years to see that.
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah.
You know, and he smiled, cool. He patted me on the shoulder and he's like, all right, well, we got more work to do. Let's go. You know what I mean? Yeah. He just wanted to move on from it. But it was this really nice little moment where I just kind of told him like, hey, you're making one of my dreams come true here. This is pretty cool.
Wow.
And as part of the segue, because we've just mentioned Toby and we'll go into obviously a deeper thing, but first project I remember you talking about with him was a White Zombie remake. I remember being really excited about your stories with that.
I remember hearing a lot about that.
Yeah. So that was, so we met, we had the same manager. This is 2007. We worked together from 2007 to 2009. And the intro to him was Sacrilege, was Jackals. Mm-hmm. And he read it and he wanted to discuss it. So we met at my manager's place and they have this story that I told in my little kind of eulogy type thing that I put on Facebook and on Dread Central, where we had met several times. I met him at Dave's Video in the 90s, which was a Laserdisc store. And then I ended up on the set, along with, it sounds like everybody else in the horror crowd, I was on the set of Toolbox Murders.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And got to watch him work two different days. And so he kind of knew me, but we weren't tight or anything. And I was kind of surprised that he would recognize me. But I was late for that meeting and I had to park on the street and it was in the heart of Hollywood. It was a terrible, terrible, you know, parking situation. And as I'm walking to the building, I see a black Humvee blocking traffic trying to parallel park. And I'm walking along the sidewalk and I'm like, oh, that poor bastard's in hell right now. People are honking at him and he's just desperately, he can't get it. He keeps pulling back out to kind of angle himself. And sure enough, at the wheel, Toby Hooper. And he sees me on the sidewalk and he kind of pulls himself out of the driver's side, pops his head out and says, Jared, can you help me park this goddamn thing?
Oh my God, that's so Toby.
And
what
so,
kind of car was it again?
It was a Hummer.
Hummer? Okay.
Yeah, it was a big black Humvee. Big military
Arnold Schwarzenegger
vehicle.
Thing,
yeah. Okay.
And so he was having the hardest time. So I did the whole hand gestures and emphatic signaling to get him to park. But that so we met so that we hit it off right there.
Yeah.
And he did recognize me, which shocked me.
Yeah.
And then we met and we hit it off and I loved what he had to say about Sacrilege and I loved that he was excited to make it. And he kind of saw it as a piece of material that might kind of help put him back on map, because he was in kind of straight to video. And he made some good stuff. I mean, Jason and Adam stuff with him.
I think Toolbox is really
Toolbox is really good.
I revisited that a few days ago, and it is one of his better movies.
Yeah. Totally.
Sure.
From the modern era, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. He was going to do it. And he almost got it made. We almost got it made with Toby three times. Three different crash and burn situations where we were up here and then boom. But in the kind of interim, White Zombie came up, and it was a company that came to him and said, we want to remake White Zombie.
Which I'm totally intrigued by, because that movie is like racist.
Oh,
and
well,
like, it's
your
moments.
You might be thinking, well, yes, but you know what's more racist, I think, and God, it's like just saying that like that. I Walked with a Zombie is a little bit more racist.
But those films are like of their time.
They are. They're
the
of
race
their
relations
time.
Are different of their time. Yeah. So they're all racist.
Well, I guess I'll say that society. The interesting thing about the
I love I'll Walk with a Zombie, by the way.
There were RKO in the mid-2000s was actually back on their feet, and they were going to remake, like, because the remakes were hot, and they were going to remake all of their catalog horror stuff. And none of it ended up happening. I don't think any of it happened.
None of it. But I remember almost everyone I knew was attached
going
to
pitching.
One
Yeah. Mine ended up being Five Came Back, which is not a horror movie, but they wanted me to turn it into a horror movie. It was really interesting. But initially, they came to Toby and me to do I Walk with a Zombie. And so to refresh our memory of I Walk with a Zombie, we watched it. And the first thing I said to Toby was, geez, wouldn't it be more interesting to do the backstory? Like, I Walk with a Zombie, the nurse is hired and she comes flying in, you know, from out of town, and she comes to this plantation and she meets the wife who's now this kind of strange catatonic. She's a zombie and she's been turned into a zombie. And it's all this mystery of what happened, what was done to her, why was it done. And I said, just wouldn't it be interesting to do the backstory more? So we didn't get I Walk with a Zombie. And then for I don't know how it happened, but he ended up with different producers who wanted to do White Zombie. And White Zombie was public domain. So it was like it was just a matter of just Toby Hooper's White Zombie. And so he met with them and they said, we would love to do this with you. And he said, well, I'm already working with a writer that I think would be great for it. So I went in and met with them. They read a script of mine called Killers of the Dead, which was another script that just wouldn't go away. And it was a zombie script, and they read that, and they were like, well, this guy clearly knows the zombie stuff, and he's working with Toby, so, you know, if he's not a complete lunatic or an idiot, then we'll have him write the script. So we watched White Zombie together, and basically in a strange way, I Walk with a Zombie feels like a sequel to White Zombie. White Zombie is all about a plantation owner in Haiti, white guy, who has basically Haitian workers, and amongst his kind of, you know, employees is a guy named Murder Legendre, who's played by Bela Lugosi. Yeah. And he's a Bokor. He's a voodoo sorcerer. And he can make zombies. And he's been making basically slaves, living dead slaves to work on this guy's plantation. So he becomes obsessed with this girl that is about to get married. There's a guy in Haiti that she's engaged to. She has come over on the boat and she's excited about the wedding, but he has fallen in love with her during the cruise. She doesn't want anything to do with him. So he goes to Bela Lugosi and says, what can we do? Is there like a love potion? Is there something you can do to artificially get her to, you know, fall in love with me? And he says, well, no, she's way too in love with her fiance. I met her and I can tell. But there is one thing that you can do. And so they turn her into a zombie. And she becomes this kind of, you know, slave.
Dead girl.
Now, and that's what we did with it.
Yeah.
And Dead Girl hadn't come out yet either, which is crazy. Another one of those things where it's like, God, just seeing these things come out and it being like just heartbreaking, because it's like Dead Girl was such a good movie and they handled it so well. And I told Trent Haga, I was like, you almost kind of killed our whole thing, because Toby and I saw Dead Girl and we were like, well, we can't beat this. Like, this is, my God. So we were working on White Zombie. White Zombie, 2 years of almost and coming really close. And then we came ridiculously close. We came really, really close to getting it made. We had a full-blown production meeting with a company that lasted 8 hours one day.
Wow.
And it's still on Wikipedia.
It's on Wikipedia. I know.
Wikipedia that you guys are still doing
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I know. It's like we're with this weird – Toby and I are a weird little footnote in Wikipedia on the Wikipedia page for White Zombie.
Oh, it says that there were rights issues.
I know you can't tell us what happened in that room.
Mm.
But the story you told me once about what Toby said to you afterwards,
yes.
I feel like that stuck with me as when Toby passed, straight away that's what popped in my head because it seemed to somehow – tell you something about the man, this kind of zen-like thing. And I don't think that part's out of school particularly, but that's up to you.
I'm trying to think if I can tell that story. There was a decision to be made about whether or not we were going to make White Zombie with the people that were going to make White Zombie.
Right. Mm-hmm.
There were indeed rights issues, but that was only kind of half of it. The other half of it was the people that we were talking to were not on the same page about anything. Mm. And they weren't on the same page about the script, and they weren't on the same page about Toby. I got some very kind of like unease from them about whether or not they felt Toby was competent enough to direct it, which pissed me the fuck off to the point where I just didn't want to work with them. Mm. On top of just these notes and these things that they were saying. And so we had that meeting, and the meeting was a disaster. It was a complete disaster in terms of what they wanted to do to the script. I hadn't signed my deal yet. And so we were in this really kind of precarious spot where I could sign my deal, which, by the way, was not a good deal. I was being advised against it. Mm. And... there's something rumbling going on.
Oh, that's the screening. Oh,
yeah. Okay.
that Ryan's at.
That would be Ryan, the base of the screening room next
door. There's loud noises.
And it's not even close to here.
It's the Hollywood it's the Hollywood police coming to stop me from telling the story. So the meeting went really badly. It didn't seem like it was going to be a good situation. There were a lot of producers for a movie that was going to have a very small budget, and they all had different things that didn't mesh. And Toby was not being treated respectfully, and I was very unhappy with that. And Toby, I think, had gotten used to that at that point, which made me really sad. Mm. And so I talked to Toby, and he said, look, I can't tell you what to do. Like, I absolutely cannot tell you what to do in this circumstance. But you haven't signed your deal yet, which means that they don't actually have control of the script. Now, I have this garden in my backyard that I've been meaning for years to really kind of tend to. It's something that's kind of gotten overgrown, and I've got this stuff. I really want to replace it with bamboo. Have you ever seen like a bamboo garden, Jared? Have you ever seen like when they set it all up in a row? There's bamboo, you know, and you got to kind of line it up. And I'm like, yeah, yeah. It's like, you know, and I've got this equipment and all this stuff that I want to do. And I've been looking at this, and he went on easily for 10 minutes about this bamboo garden that he wanted to design in his backyard. And I didn't know where he was going. And you have to realize that sometimes Toby would go off on flights and you would just kind of have to strap in, you know. And I got to the end of this whole thing about this garden and I said, Toby, what the hell are you trying to say to me? And he said, what I'm saying is I would rather spend the next 6 months working in my garden than working on this version of this movie.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so that was decision made.
Yeah.
And so the rights issue was a real thing, and that's it's not bullshit. The rights issue is really, really strange. The White Zombie plagiarized material, the original White Zombie plagiarized material from a book called The Magic Island by W.D. Seabrook,
which became a Broadway play, correct?
Also with no
rights. No rights. Huh.
It was called Zombie, the stage play. And the Seabrook estate sued them successfully. And it was Victor Halperin, which, by the way, was our running joke on Zombie Redneck Torture Family, because we had a White Zombie question, which was who was the director of White Zombie.
Oh, and you got it wrong.
And I got it wrong.
And we were like, you wrote the
God.
So
really?
Wow. Anytime that we wouldn't know something, everybody would look at me and I would say, Victor Halperin. Yeah. Let's just put down Victor Halperin. So we'd put it down for everything.
Wasn't the other Halperin involved as well? Edward.
Yes, both the Halperin brothers, basically.
So it could have been Edward.
So there is material in The Magic Island. The Magic Island isn't a fiction book. It's a travelogue. When Haiti became occupied, There was this adventurer who used to go to exotic places and write books about all the things he had seen and done and all the different cultures and all the different adventures he had had. And he went to Haiti.
His name
when
was Bill Pullman.
And he went and he taught. It was the first time in America, to my knowledge, I might be wrong about this. Jovanka might say otherwise. But my memory of the research was it was the first time the word zombie came into the American lexicon was from this book.
That's the accepted.
Yeah, that's the accepted thing.
That's what everybody was.
There's an argument about whether or not there was like one other reference to the word zombie before that, but basically what it was this Haitian reference that was made.
Yeah, that book was also the first time that people got kind of exposure to what was supposed to be this creepy voodoo religion and the fact that they were zombifying people and that ghosts were part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it became a surge right after that, which is why they did the Broadway play. Like suddenly everybody was obsessed with Haiti
zombie,
and voodoo.
Zombie crazy. So like the book was a travelogue, but the two chapters about zombies were the thing that caught on. So they just stole the two chapters about zombies and made a movie out of it.
Wow.
And it's not acknowledged. It's not credited. They didn't pay the Seabrook estate for any of it. And so when we were working on an iteration of it, it was not this version, but the lawyers were like, you guys can't do this. Like, we're going to have to buy the rights to this book. And we were like, why do we have to buy the rights to a book? Like, and the book is 100-something years
old. Yeah, I was going to say, isn't the book in public domain now?
No.
Oh, the Seabrook
estate still owns the rights.
Wow.
So it wasn't. Now, again, White Zombie is public domain. They've never sued the Halperins over this. They've never sued for profits to White Zombie. And it's been in public domain for as long as I can remember. So I don't know that you would even be able to do any kind of bookkeeping on who, you know, what portion of it.
Mm.
So it's never been a thing. And so I was arguing like, let's just do it. Like, why do we have to, you know, and of course, I'm like the screenwriter. I just want to go, go, go. They want to argue about legal stuff. So that was a real thing. And then it looked like that was going to get ironed out, but it was still a question mark. And it was the easiest kind of story because I couldn't. This is all about contracts and internal infighting and, you know, other stuff that was going on with this project. So really the easiest kind of story to tell was like, yeah, there's plagiarism. And it, I mean, that's bad. Like, you would not want to be doing the remake of something where it's like, oh, by the way, the guys from 1931 plagiarized something and you're going to get sued for it.
Yep.
Yeah, wow. That's crazy.
You know,
who would think that's possible? I wouldn't have thought that.
Right.
Especially with something as generic as a zombie.
Right.
Yeah. Something is part of, you know.
But at the time, that was where they came from. It's almost like George with Night of the Living Dead where it went into public domain. And, you know what I mean? It's like, so wait, how can it, so he doesn't own the rights to the cannibal zombie, to the flesh-eating ghoul?
Yeah.
No, because of the whole public domain thing. It's the same thing with White Zombie. Wow. W.D. Seabrook introduced the zombie to America, and it became something that everybody then just stole and used.
And remember that Bram Stoker's estate, he was dead at the time, so his estate sued Nosferatu.
Yeah, I remember that.
Same thing. That was the thing. It was going on like crazy.
Nosferatu does, and they even...
Yeah, takes lots of stuff.
Nosferatu also made the mistake where they actually put on the publicity posters that they put up in Germany, borrowed freely from Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yeah.
And not a bit of rights were paid.
Well, because the movie industry was very kind of wild west point, you know, and so nobody knew. It's like, well, how are they gonna, you know, sue us? We're gonna make a movie, we're gonna make millions, it's not gonna matter. We'll give them a couple of $100,000 and we'll move on. So it was just going on really rampant, and so we didn't want to get hurt by, well, I didn't care, but they didn't want to get sued for it by, you know, people that had nothing to do with any of it but were the descendants,
yeah,
you know. But it was a fun, yeah, so that sucked. And that, so that was from 2007 to 2009, and that kind of broke us in terms of our partnership because it was so devastating. Like, we had gotten so close. Yeah. We were so excited about that script. He was so excited to make that movie, and we were trying to get Sacrilege going all the time, and that was stalling, and so he finally – the thing with Toby that I think – and, I you know, Jason Adam might be able to kind of answer to this too, but if you look at his career, he would work with the same writers for like a couple of movies – and then move on. You have like Dan O'Bannon and Kim Henkel.
Yeah.
And you've got Jason Adam. And, you know, we didn't get anything done, but I worked with him, you know. And strangely enough, Jonathan Scheck was working with him on From a Buick 8 while we were working on White Zombie. And then Jonathan Scheck is in Jackals.
Yeah.
So it just gets weirder and weirder. But, so I think he just kind of had this almost – it was almost like you were his kind of girlfriend in a way, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, there would be this point where it would just be like, you know – the love is gone, or I just don't think this is working out anymore.
Yeah, apparently he uses that garden line on everyone. He's got a long line of talking about some bamboo garden that he's never done.
Breakup.
It's go to. It's go to.
But you look at the Dan O'Bannon era, and it's like he went off and did Return of the Living Dead without Toby, and that was it. They didn't work together anymore, but they did two. Well, if you count Return of the Living Dead, which they worked on really closely, there's a lot of Toby in Return of the Living Dead. You know, they did Life Force, Invaders from Mars. And
who wrote The Dark?
I'm staring at
it
right now.
Was that a hire gig for him? Do you remember?
I have no idea, but Toby cast James Caron.
James Caron.
In Return of the Living Dead.
Yes, yes. Cool. Well, he cast James Caron in Return of the Living Dead. That's 100% true, and that's why...
Why he's in Invaders from Mars.
That's why he's in Invaders from Mars.
Yeah.
And the Skeleton Farm story comes from Poltergeist. They used the whole mythology with Poltergeist is that they had real skeletons in the movie.
Oh, yeah. You wrote a lovely article about that
So the whole thing was that somebody, when they were looking into plastic skeletons or imitation skeletons versus real ones, somebody told Toby about skeleton farms in India, and it stuck. He just loved it. And that whole story that James Caron from Poltergeist tells in Return of the Living Dead came from... Working on Poltergeist.
Interesting.
Came from just a weird kind of anecdote about where do we get real skeletons? Where do they grow real? How do you get real skeletons?
Yeah.
You know, like there's something shady there. And this dude, you know, had him going for a minute, you know, for 5 minutes talking about skeleton farms before he laughed in his face. It's like, there aren't skeleton farms, Toby. But yeah, he was heavily. And the funny thing about Return of the Living Dead, I often wonder, and maybe this is like a weird segue, but I often wonder what would have happened if Toby had done Return of the Living Dead instead of Life Force.
Yeah, I remember, God, this is a long time ago, but there was also posters for something called Toby Hooper's Zombie.
Yes.
From what, the last 10 years or so?
That was Adam and Jace.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
Yeah. I didn't know. Yeah.
And it got made into something else.
Oh, it did get made, but not with any of them involved.
Pretty Dead Things.
Pretty,
really? That's so weird.
Look up Adam and Jace on their filmography.
Hold on.
And they didn't
I'm
end
on
up.
Toolbox Murders right now. I can get
think
over there.
That it went on without them, too. I think that it was mutated into, they had to get credit for it, but it wasn't something that they actually worked on that version of it. I could be wrong.
I don't see there's a poster for it.
They went to markets. They went to international markets.
Hands down, the weirdest thing I ever saw in my whole life is the ad for Spider-Man.
Oh my
where
God!
Where it says Toby Hooper from Canon. I remember seeing that one day and my jaw hit the ground because I just couldn't even in my brain. I can't even know what that would be.
Yeah, I want to see it right now.
I wish we lived in that alternate universe that exists.
I know. No, that whole Canon era is so amazing.
Yeah, and it's obviously so he had a weird relationship with them with the movies he got to do.
Well,
but,
and you know, I think a real. I mean, obviously, there's the documentary. What's it called?
Electric Boogaloo.
Electric Boogaloo.
Yeah, which is great.
There's a lot of great stories, and I'll share my Toby story. With his commentary that he did for Invaders from Mars with Michael Felsher was great.
Yes.
And that was one of those gigs that I got. I'd met Toby a few times here and there, but again, like not under any circumstances would he actually remember who the hell I was. But this is fun. Like Mike Mendez introduced me to him at the Saw 6 premiere. He's like, he's right over there. I'll say, you know, let's say hi. But it was one of those calls. I think I'd supervised the commentary for the Funhouse, which was fun and it was cool. But Michael Felsher had called me up and was just like, all right, I don't need you to do the commentary, but Toby doesn't drive anymore. Would you drive him to it? And I'm like, oh, my God, yeah. I mean, that's kind of like, yeah, I'll totally do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the funniest aspects of that is I get his address, and he literally lives a block away from Sean Keller, who is one of my best friends of all time.
Yes.
So when I'm going there, I'm like passing Sean's house, and then I'm like, holy shit, did Toby Hooper live here this entire time?
And I live a mile and a half from there.
Yeah. And then I remember telling Sean that right after.
Yeah.
And like, I get a text from him 15 minutes later saying, does he own a black Trans Am that's like totally like defunct in his drive? And I'm like, yep. And he's like, I just walked around the block and I was like, that's got to be his house.
Oh my gosh.
Some of those fun, nerdy things in the world. Yeah, yeah. Oh my God, Toby lives so close.
Yep.
So I picked him up and we're so used to just plugging in addresses in our phone and then whatever. So I pick him up and his girlfriend and we're driving around for a really long time. And I'm taking like highways in California that I've never taken before in my life. And I'm like, I've been in the studio before and I'm pretty sure this isn't the way to go there.
Mm-hmm.
And long story short,
I am really fucking lost in East LA. And I'm terrified because, like, he's one of my heroes and I'm, like, really late. And I don't – and I when I realize that, I pull over and I'm like, oh, my God, I totally put in the wrong address. And so I put in the right address and it's going to be another 30 minutes before we get there. And I'm terrified that he's going to, like, get mad or yell at me. I was like, I don't want to get yelled at by Toby Hooper.
Yeah.
So I just turn around. I'm like, I'm really, really sorry, but I put in the wrong address or I was given the wrong address. It's going to take us 30 minutes to get to this place. Is that okay? And he's like, yeah, as long as we could pull over in that burger joint there, that'd be far out. And I'm like, okay, because he said that. He says far out a lot.
Far out and groovy.
Wow.
He's like, let's go to that burger joint. That'd be far out.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, all right. Yeah. So we pulled over, and he's just like having chili burgers with Toby before this commentary. He's like, no one will believe this. I can't tell anyone. So I think I tweeted a photo because – it was like some weird Mexican burger joint. Uh-huh. And the thing we both commented on is that refills were 23 cents plus tax, which made me, I was like, where are
we? That's a very peculiar number.
It's a very specific thing. So I took a picture of it and I was like, I'm lost in East LA having chili burgers with a legendary director. But by the way, 23 cents refills plus tax.
So you get 2 cents back with your quarter. Maybe the tax is 2 cents.
It was very bizarre. So. But he was so sweet. And we got to the commentary session. And it was really, you know, I hope Felcher has been doing more of this, but he Skyped in and recorded his side on his end, and they recorded Toby there so that when they put it together, it was seamless. But, you know, Michael Felcher's film knowledge is just terrific. And so although it was specifically about Invaders from Mars, Michael talked to him about the entire canon run, those three pictures and how everything happened. I mean, there's cool stuff like basically he didn't want to do Texas Chainsaw 2, but it was part of his deal to produce it.
Yep.
So he was naming like, well, Russell Mulcahy was going to direct it. He's naming all the other directors and then finally ended up just being him. He did it.
Right. Under really, really incredibly stressful shorts.
Yes.
I mean, like they were shooting it in July and it came out in August.
Yeah. And I don't even think the script was done when they started it or whatever. They were running and gunning.
The story of Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 is pretty almost as wild as Texas Chainsaw 1.
Yeah. So I strongly recommend that commentary. The only other thing that I love about that day was he got in there and the owner Private Tracks is the studio that we did it at. The owner comes up to him and he's like, can I get you some coffee? And he's like, yes. And they're like, how do you take it? Strong. And I was like, I will never forget that moment because that's one of my favorite responses to a coffee question ever.
Strong. Yeah,
so,
he would say far out and right on and groovy. And I mean, he had all that 70s kind of stuff locked in. Like he just never stopped using those terms.
So I had this hanging on my office wall for the longest time, and now it's hanging in my my dining room at home. But a couple, gosh, it's probably been 8 years ago now, the Fango office was moving from, we'd always had this office over on 9th Avenue, and we were moving over to 34th Street, or at one point we moved up to 9th.
Back in New York.
Back in New York, yeah. So we were moving offices, which in my decade and some odd years tenure there, we did a couple of times. So we were moving offices with the new owner and we were cleaning out the file cabinets. And when I say that Fango has file cabinets, like literally we have these these things weighed a ton. They were not like a normal file cabinet. These were like triple wide and we probably had 30 of them filled to the brim with files because back in the 70s and 80s, anytime a film was coming out, you would not only send over like a press pack, you would send over pages upon pages of document and send over tons of sheets of slides that the magazines could use to use in their magazine photos. And so we're cleaning it out and I find this thing. And it wasn't even in one of the files. Like it was not even in like a specific file. It was just kind of like sitting at the bottom of the drawer. And it was a letter from Toby Hooper to Fango picking apart their review of Invaders from Mars, but it is written on Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 stationery, which is called Saw 2.
Saw 2.
Yeah. On the stationery, it just says Saw 2. Mm-hmm.
That's how he always referred to it, too, by the way.
Yeah. And so it's Saw 2 letterhead from the desk of Toby Hooper, and it is Toby Hooper going bit by bit through the very not polite.
He was very angry about it.
He was very angry.
I've seen it as well. Yeah.
And it's fantastic. Yeah. It's like,
Wow.
Yeah, and he is.
You can't blame him because Jim Woinowski wrote the article. And we all know what Jim Woinowski does when he writes for Fango. A good killer POV reference to go back to. Wow. Read his Shining review.
Oh, and I promise I won't write the guy that wrote the nasty review of Jackals bit by bit about why he's wrong about his negative review.
It was very Toby of him to read it because it really is just like, and the writer needs to take note that in this particular scene at, you know, number minute five, that this happens, that it's so specific.
He was a very, very specific, meticulous guy.
Yeah.
And he really had his film idols. He loved Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah.
And he loved David Lynch. And he tells that great story. He tells that great story about Stanley Kubrick. He told it to me, and then I saw he did it at a Q&A. And I mean, it was a great thing where he was in England. I don't know if it was for Life Force or what it was for, but he was at Pinewood or wherever it was. And he found out that Kubrick was somewhere in the vicinity on the grounds. And so he went to like an assistant or a receptionist or something and said, "Hey, is Stanley here? I would love to meet Stanley Kubrick." And she like turned him away, like, "Thank you very much," you know. And he said, "Well, could you just let him know that Toby Hooper was here and that, you know, I'm a huge fan and thank you very much." So he goes out to his car, and evidently Stanley Kubrick came running out into the parking lot and stopped him from leaving
and embraced him.
I think. Gave him a big hug, and he wanted to talk about Texas Chainsaw Massacre. He had a thousand questions about how they made it. But the punchline of the story that Toby always tells is, so he was in an edit bay working on The Shining. This is like 82 or 83.
Yeah. Like a couple years after the movie.
And what Toby's, the great punchline, I can't do it, I'm ruining it, but the punchline was, you know, he walked away. Toby walked away from that meeting thinking that he was still working on The Shining. He's like, "God damn it, I'm going to get this thing right if it kills me." That he was still working on it, that he was still editing it.
That was
still
his MO, right?
Like, yeah.
But somebody put it really well when Toby passed. They put it really well about Chainsaw. They said that's the horror movie that affected all the horror directors, all the great people, whether it was we saw in one of my favorite Q&As ever.
It's
the impact it made on Friedkin.
Oh my God.
One of my favorite screenings ever. Yeah. I agree with you. And he also was able to, a lot of people said like Toby didn't really recount all his stories anymore, but that night,
Friedkin was
able to dig in and get these amazing responses and stories. And and I think that was the one that there's no other horror movie that affected, because a lot of the great directors that we all revere who made great horror, our favorite horror films, and I'm talking about the Carpenters and Romeros, not a single one of them wanted to be a horror director. One thing they have in common is they wanted to make movies, in quote marks. They made one horror film that happened to be hit a zeitgeist, and then all of them get stuck in the horror film.
Yeah.
They grew to love it, and they grew to understand how to make their movies in horror, but to a T.
Yep.
Toby's one of them.
Yep.
They all had that in common, and Kubrick was probably one of the only ones who's probably lucky enough because he came to it later. He didn't make a horror film first.
Right.
He made a horror film much later. So I find that really interesting that it's the one movie that they almost are universally affected by.
And Texas Chainsaw, I mean, I said this before on my tribute post, which is it's for every horror fan, it's a rite of passage. Is the film that no matter what is that you are forever changed after you experience it, whenever it is you experience it.
Oh, it traumatized me.
Yeah, and it's never the same after that. And I think you tweeted and I agree with you, unparalleled, probably the greatest horror movie ever made.
I just think it's the one that's most effective because it its purpose is different, I think, than a lot of other horror films where it's about entertainment and scaring. I feel like this one's to like shake you up and shake up the world. Romero has that in him too. Mm-hmm. But I got the feeling like Toby was trying to make a film that's like a nightmare, that's like all these things, but he wants to like rattle everyone.
Yeah.
And he does that.
I always think that most people remember the first time they saw Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Mm-hmm. Like you can remember exactly when you saw it, what you were doing, and who you were with, just because it does shake you to the point that it kind of becomes like a landmark moment. So you can recall that moment.
Yeah, it doesn't hit beat sheets. It doesn't hit any of the shit.
No.
It just is outside the box of what something should be and the way you should feel about it. And
Well, what impressed me about, I just revisited the 40th anniversary Blu-ray, but in particular that screening that you and I went to with Friedkin. Is 40 years later, and it's timeless. There's something about some quality, and you know, there's other films of his I like, but that's just once in a lifetime you get a movie like that that just transcends.
Yeah,
and it is from start to finish like the epitome of what I consider, you know, a, a great, a perfect horror movie.
Yeah. It broke. I told the story on my little write up about Toby. It broke me. I was really scared of horror films, but I was drawn to them. And I was scared of them. And so I would kind of, it was almost like this weird, like, torture. It was like, well, I want to watch them, but they scare me. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, it was the scene where she's tied to the chair and the camera starts getting into her eyeball.
The darting eyeball,
and she's screaming and screaming and screaming. And I remember, I don't remember much about watching it the first time, but I do remember the moment where I almost let out like a yelp because I couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah.
And it really, and it broke, and I was like 10.
The connection to that, though, I think, and where actually the eyeball specifically was getting me, is the fact that the other movie that did this is Psycho. The other movie that broke everything and like was totally against what was being done and like rattled everyone and like shocked everyone. I feel like those two movies have something a lot in common. I feel like Toby really knew what Psycho was doing. He couldn't do that because this has to be the opposite. And this is a hippie generation and Vietnam's going on and war footage is coming back.
You know,
it was fascinating how he was able to incorporate all of his influences into that one movie, because the eyeball thing, and again, I learned this all from that freaking Q&A, and this is one of the things I talked to Toby about on that drive, was Frankenheimer's Seconds. Because he mentioned it. He's like, he mentioned it at the Q&A. It's one of his favorite movies, and it was total huge influence on it. There was also a famous painting that you look at this thing, and it's totally the epitome of Texas Chainsaw. But as soon as I popped, because Criterion put out Seconds, and as soon as I popped it in, it's not to the extent that it is in Texas Chainsaw, but in the opening shot, there's all these close-ups of eyeballs. You're like, oh, that's I totally get that.
Great
but Jerry he like Goldsmith. Amped it to 11.
Yeah. Great
in
Drake
the way that he
used
it. It's just amazing how all of that worked in that one movie. And I would like to talk about what other films in his filmography, because he's got to be one of the most diverse and weird filmmakers, because even stuff that I don't 100% love or like, there's interesting things about it.
Always.
Because
and it's
he
often
had a very
dark sense of humor. It seems to be one of the connective tissues.
Well, I mean, I think it's hilarious that he considers the first Chainsaw comedy. And he's like, but nobody got it. So I went overboard for two. You know, it's like, so two, like the comedy is very prevalent, or at least the dark comedy of it.
Yeah. And two, I consider, I always say that two is the Toby Hooper movie exists.
I would agree.
It is the most Toby Hooper.
Because Toby definitely has this kind of over-the-top caricature comedic style that we see emerge in things like Eaten Alive or The Mangler or even The Funhouse to a degree.
Well, he is one of the Sawyer. Yeah. Like, he is one of those guys from that family.
Yeah. But with the way that, you know, halfway through Chainsaw 2, everything, the color scheme changes, the lighting changes. In the scene where Chop Top is down in the basement of the radio station, everything gets weird. And it stays weird for the whole rest of the movie. All the subterranean stuff is lit in a really weird – it's not lit the way the first half – the first 25 minutes of that movie is very kind of grounded, and it's lit normally. It's lit from above. It's lit the way that rooms would be lit. And then all of a sudden Chop Top shows up, and everything stylistically changes, and it gets very kind of EC comics.
It's
kind of creep like show. It's got this Argento thing, and there's
also
other
influences. I also felt like a fuck you to my favorite scene of showing it in classes before. It feels like he read Carol Clover's article and goes, oh, yeah, you want to see those ideas? Here's a literal scene where I'm going to show you beat for beat the things you're writing about, like where Stretch has her legs spread, and the ice is being done.
Now,
she's getting wet because he's got the giant drill going in.
Right.
I mean, it's literally like he's poking fun at the whole
thing. The only reason that that wouldn't be the case is because Clover actually gauges the slasher era from Texas Chainsaw 1 to Texas Chainsaw 2.
But people were still making those comments.
Yes.
Making connections.
Well, and who knows if she had a paper or anything like that.
But
no,
it just
I know.
He feels like so self-aware before we were doing self-aware.
Absolutely.
I mean, even the poster, obviously, they went the Breakfast Club thing at one point.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I didn't get that for years.
I didn't
either. Somebody pointed it out. I was like, oh, that's pretty funny.
And I remember being really intrigued by the box cover, seeing it in the video store, because usually like a horror box cover, you know, there it's dark and it's foreboding, and this one they're just like sitting there and it's like full light, and I was so confused by why they would be positioned like that, and then I got it like decades later.
But I honestly think that it was the rush job that made it so Toby, because there was no time to think about it.
Yeah, it was just like instinctual and just
whatever they came up with was what went on the page, and then they shot it, and that was kind of what that movie was like, and that's why it's such a weird. I talked to him about it, and he considers Texas Chainsaw. We considered God. I have to say it in past tense and it bums me out. It's the first time I did that. he considered Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 to be an unfinished film.
Hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
He had to set up with the whole thing with the second unit that didn't understand what kind of movie they were making. And so, like, the football parking garage massacre sequence there's no remnant of it whatsoever, was shot by a second unit director who didn't understand what they were shooting. And if you watch there's a really bad VHS work print deleted scenes on all of the different home video versions. Mm. And there's, like, a smoke machine in the van with a big bright, like, light coming out of it, like it's Poltergeist or something. And it's like, this is not Toby's thing, but he had to trust the second unit director, who it turns out didn't have a clue about what Toby was trying to accomplish, because there was no time to really discuss any of it. Hmm. So this guy went off to do, you know, massacre stuff, and Toby's off doing stuff with Dennis Hopper and Carolyn Williams.
You mean Lefty and Stretch.
Lefty.
The worst hero ever. Lefty, he's just so unheroic.
Yes.
Every time he tries to help, it goes wrong.
It goes wrong. No, no. So yeah, I think that might be the reason why it is the Toby Hooperest of all the Toby Hooper movies. But it really is, like, to me, that's the one. Whenever I kind of miss him, I would throw Texas Chainsaw 2 on, because to me it would give me the most vibe of him.
What's everyone's other favorite? I'm curious.
I was just going to say with Texas Chainsaw 2, is not my favorite. But I do remember one scene that I always thought would have been Toby Hooper-y, which was I remember hearing about a scene that was cut from Texas Chainsaw 2 where it was supposed to be the family murdering movie patrons.
Yes.
And it was supposed to be really self-aware with Joe Bob Briggs. Yeah. And I was like that.
It's in the deleted scene.
Oh, it is in the deleted scene.
And it's terrible.
Oh, it's terrible.
So it's kind of like the Gremlins 2 of
Deleted scenes.
You know, it has that heightened sense.
The deleted scenes are fascinating. They're great to watch. None of them are good. Yeah. They all justifiably were cut from there. Mm. They would have ruined the movie. But what's weird about it is, as a result, the movie doesn't really have a second act. Yeah. It has a first act and a third act, and it's like a 50-minute first act and then like a 50-minute second act or like a 45-minute second act, third act. And so in terms of just like a movie where they had to take what they had and put it in the theater, they had a release date. That was the thing. They started writing it, I think, in April or May. They were shooting it in June. They finished on the 4th of July, where they had another 26-hour last day. And then they were in post up till August 17th or whenever it was it came out. And it went out.
That's crazy.
It's basically a clean kind of work print.
Like it went out unrated.
Yeah, unrated because they didn't have time.
Which affected the following movie.
They didn't have time to do anything with the MPAA, to mess around with the MPAA with trying to get an R rating, so they just put it out as is. And that was the thing. That's the amazing thing about that movie. But yeah, the story that Kit Carson tells about the last day of filming is that he had a typewriter on the set and he would be rewriting stuff while they were working. And they were wrapping the last shot of the last scene of the movie, and he was still writing. And one of the crew guys said, "Kit, we're done. We're packing up. We're going home." And he's like, "Yeah, but I haven't finished writing the script yet." And it's like this great, like that was, he said, and that encapsulated the whole experience.
Wow. Yeah.
Because he was writing on set shit that they would hand the pages off to the actors, and they would look at it, and they would go and do it. And then that was in the movie.
Well, which is funny because as a kid, I think that it's probably Texas Chainsaw 2 is probably my favorite after the original Texas Chainsaw. I mean, I like his other films, but that one I remember literally I used to sleep over my high school best friend's house, David, who sadly is also no longer with us. And we literally, I don't know, we were lunatics. We like drank soda, stayed up all night and watched Texas Chainsaw 2 on repeat. By the morning, I thought I'd lost my mind because we're like, he's like, let's watch it again. And I'm like, okay. And I don't know why. And by the end of it, but we would never notice like that the structure of it. And we just like, this is the most insane 90
it's
minutes
insane.
Both
ever
one
put on
and
film.
Two push insanity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They totally
yeah.
Do, in different ways.
Different ways.
Nobody,
yeah, funny, but
nobody did madness like Toby.
Yeah, no,
and I had a conversation with him once about that, because when you look at like the majority of his movies, the only one that really doesn't have it is Poltergeist. And, you know, I mean, we can argue about, I know his side of that story, interestingly enough, but Eaten Alive.
That thing's batshit crazy.
Oh my God.
And it's funny because like everybody in Eaten Alive is crazy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That movie's bonkers.
It's crazy.
Yeah. It's
everyone is insane.
I haven't seen it since the transfer. I saw it on VHS a long time ago.
The Arrow video one.
I had Steve Scarlatta come over and watch, and it's the thing that Eaten Alive showcases is his understanding of color scheme.
Yes.
And like the lighting on that movie is just really impressive. And
because
like,
it's a studio movie,
it's
right?
It's all done on a stage.
Which is the total
including the
of
exteriors.
Chainsaw.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really
like a
weird
total
thing.
Flip.
And it feels like Texas Chainsaw 2. Like it feels like a sequel to Texas Chainsaw in its own weird way. It's got the same, it's set in Texas.
It's based on a real event.
It's based on a real event.
Yeah.
And it's got the same tone. And
I don't know if you know it, Jekyll's is also based on real life.
Oh, God.
No, the story for this one.
I begged them to take that off of there.
Dave and I will do this one during one of the bonus episodes sometime. But Eaten Alive is actually based on a guy in, I think it was in Texas, who used to be really proud of his pet alligators and would show them off. Like, this would be like his thing. Like, hey, baby, come over to my house and see my pet alligators.
Right.
And then after he got sick of girlfriends, he started feeding them to the pet alligators.
Yeah, no, I actually looked into the story. They couldn't prove that he ever actually did that because they found bodies elsewhere, but it is the myth came
the myth
from that. But
right.
But you guys can go deeper on your show.
Yeah, because
so
all of
out.
His girlfriends kept claiming that like she actually saw them with bodies.
Yeah, no, it's cool. It's
stuff
a
like
crazy.
That.
It's crazy idea.
But that arrow,
I rewatched that.
That arrow transfer is unbelievable. And he does a little intro at the beginning, and it's so funny because it's like, do you, you know, play movie with introduction by Toby Hooper. The introduction by Toby Hooper is, hey dudes, this is Toby Hooper, the director of Eaten Alive, and you're gonna watch Eaten Alive. I hope you like the colors.
Yeah.
And it fades to black and that's it.
Wow.
It is 30 seconds long and I hope you like the colors.
But Mangler does that same thing, though Mangler is by no means my favorite Toby Hooper movie. Sorry, Mike Williamson.
But again, none of us have seen a good version of it, like a good release. I'd love
to see a good release.
I would actually like to see a good
release. I want
to
wait for that.
But even the one that I have seen, I mean, it's by far one of his most, I'll say, kind of cinematic in that regard, where it does have a lot of colors and it feels big. Yeah.
Mike sent me, Mike Williamson, our friend, who was also one of the biggest Toby Hooper fans. He sent me a little video clip on his phone of the opening of The Mangler. And I was like, you know what? That is a really great opening. It's the way that pans down into the factory. And so you're like, this is really well executed.
It's very cinematic.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And I mean, Life Force. You know, you look at Life Force.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it's batshit insane. And when I talk about structure,
yeah.
You want to talk about a movie that has no real kind of cohesive structure in terms of storytelling.
Well, I loved your review of like where you're like, he's like, Toby Hooper thought Steve Rouseback was a leading man.
He
and he went for it.
He thought which is great. And that's the thing. There was a tradition of that too. And so the thing I was going to say about Madness is that I don't know how he got those performances, but he would get them consistently.
Yeah.
And there would just be these scenes of people losing their fucking minds, having like nervous breakdowns on camera. Neville Brand in Eaten Alive. Like, I don't know what, but everybody in Eaten Alive, Robert Englund in Eaten Alive, you know, everybody is hysterical. What's her name from Texas Chainsaw Massacre?
Oh, Marilyn Burns.
Marilyn Burns.
An amazing moment.
So honestly, and I would just see that, but then he started hiring like character actors that were known for playing kind of psychopaths to play his leading men.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Railsback, who is, you know, basically at that point in time, he was Charles Manson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have the Mangler, you have Ted Levine.
And Robert,
exactly, Robert Englund. But for the romantic leads, you have Brad Dourif in Spontaneous Combustion.
Yeah, that's true.
You have all these weird, you know, and so it's like, or even like Angela Bettis in Toolbox.
Yeah.
She was not being cast as, you know, the final girl type in any of those movies. But he had this weird kind of off-kilter casting idea. But yeah, man, Life Force, and I would talk to him, and like, I was so obsessed with Life Force, and it was like, I would just talk to him. One thing I will tell you about Life Force that I got out of him when we talked about it was that he prefers the truncated American cut.
Interesting, yeah. Because I was actually just going to bring that. I don't know if the international one's available anymore.
It is. It's on the Screen
Factory. Oh, is it on the Screen Factory?
Yeah, they're both on there.
Okay.
Thank God. I mean, we didn't have the American cut for a long time. We only had the international cut on disc. And then Screen Factory, being Screen Factory, is like, well, we got to put both of them on there. So they're both on there. He preferred the American cut. And I flat out told him that I thought he was crazy.
Maybe it's because it's shorter.
Yeah,
maybe he just
that's
some
what
movie
he said.
To move.
Yeah. Yeah. He said it's shorter and tighter, and he liked some of Michael Kamen's synth score, which was, again, they took out a bunch of Mancini stuff wasn't matching up anymore because they had done so much editing to the movie that the score, the Henry Mancini score, which is amazing, had been, you know, just butchered. And they were like, well, we can't use this anymore. We've got to have him come back in. And he was booked on something else. So they got Michael Kamen to come in and do all the synthesizer stuff. And he liked synthesizer stuff. He would kind of veer more towards that with his scores. So it was just something, you know. But, Life Force, when you talk about, like, well, so, okay, Steve Railsback. Steve Railsback disappears from that movie for 25 minutes.
I feel like that's a subgenre of movies. The movies where leading characters disappear for like a huge chunk of the narrative. And then you're always like, whoa, I had forgotten who the lead of the movie is. There's a lot of movies like that, and they're always, and none of them fully can ever work because of the way we watch movies. Identification is out the window, you know?
It's almost, if you consider that Steve Railsback disappears from the movie after being the clear lead character in the first 10 minutes, then he disappears, and then we meet a whole bunch of different people that might be the lead in London.
Yeah.
But none of them really is. There's the guy from The Devils who is the first guy that kind of – he gets partially soul-sucked, and he gets weak, and he gets – you know, you have Dr. Falada, and you have the SAS, you know, the awesome actors. And it's like – and then Railsback comes back, and it's like, oh, no, wait. He really is the lead of this. It's okay, guys. He really is the lead of this movie.
But I guess she's kind of the lead. Maybe.
And then Matilda May, you know.
And thank God for that. I would much rather watch her than Steve, even though I love Railsback.
But he just did not give – two shits about if he didn't have anybody like reining him in about structure and acts and all that kind of stuff, he didn't give a crap about that stuff. Wow. He just would go with the flow and whatever it was that was cool. White Zombie was really kind of unrestrained. It's a really wide, it's the weirdest script I've ever written. And I was nervous about it when we sent it out, honestly. I'll be just completely honest, because it was so weird. And I had a reputation for writing really strong, you know, aggressive horror stuff that was really serious and dark. And so then this White Zombie thing, and like it was borderline David Lynch, like David Lynch, Twin Peaks, The Return, David Lynch.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so.
Which kind of makes sense with Toby, because he's constantly breaking rules. I think he's a lot more experimental than people ever really consciously knew.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, Funhouse is still probably my favorite other one in terms of just like it's a fun, playful movie. And even the opening like is just funny and strange. Yep. Yeah. The Psycho references are just bizarre.
And that's another one with lighting, with the crazy ass lighting.
Yeah. And it's just a lot of fun. I think that's his most fun movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that
one. You know,
one too.
It's just, it doesn't get, and it's got a dark sense of humor, and you know, it's just a strange movie. I love the strangeness. I worry that we're bleeding all the strange out of horror sometimes, like when we watch movies now and there's nothing offbeat or surprising.
Right.
He had that voice still, and you know, there's
the strangest Toby Hooper thing I've seen, and I'm having to Google it now because I'm having a flashback to it, but it was Amazing fucking Stories. Bizarre. Amazing Stories, Miss Stardust.
The very last episode
and this
of
was
Amazing
the very
Stories.
Last episode of Amazing Stories was done by Toby Hooper, and it's based off the short stories by Richard Matheson, right?
Yep.
Actually a really kind of smart topical story where it's about this beauty pageant that Earth has called the Miss Stardust. And this alien shows up and kind of takes it hostage, demanding that the pageant let in creatures from other worlds.
Okay.
And so it's got a lot of race stuff in it. But the weirdest thing is that the alien is played by Weird Al Yankovic.
Oh, right. Now I remember. Right. For some reason, I confuse this with his Tales from the Crypt. But no, this is Amazing Story.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I think Jim Sito was in it too. I think the cook.
Distinctly possible.
In the Amazing Stories episode.
Yeah, I just remember that it's Weird Al playing the alien, and like no matter how serious it's, you know, being portrayed, it's still Weird Al.
Right.
So it's still Weird Al. Yeah. And I remember being really fascinated by it though. Like I really liked that episode when it first came out. Granted, I have not seen it since the 80s, but
it's just as weird as you remember.
Okay.
Yeah. But that's the thing too, is like Spielberg would keep hiring him for things.
Yeah.
And so like whenever I know you guys had the 80 or whatever it was that was on that kind of raised that whole thing last month. And, you know, it kind of bummed me out because nothing bummed him out more than hearing that.
Mm. Yeah. And
that
you know
whole
what?
Thing.
We can address this really quickly because I've been meaning to, because it's been a lot. We've personally been getting a lot of flack since that episode aired. And the honest truth is, look, the AD said what
he told
said.
The story.
Yeah, he told the story.
I listened to it.
Whether you believe it or not is up to you.
Right.
And it certainly didn't seem like he had any reason to tell any
mis- yeah, I mean, yeah. There is,
he's
there
just
is,
recounting from his 19-year-old self.
Point is that there was no malicious intent on our part. I didn't even know he worked on Poltergeist, quite frankly, when he came into
and for two things, it would be like if I if you could ask someone to wear the Ark of the Covenant and you didn't ask. The other thing is to criticize – the one thing I take like umbrage, I guess, with is the idea that it's bad to ask a question where what if the answer had been Toby Hooper?
Right.
I know.
Right.
Yeah,
I'm asking a question that I don't know the answer to. So what if the answer was the other? Would suddenly I'd be a savior for that? That's ludicrous.
No, but
you ask questions to find out what people think. That's
from their point
perspective.
Of an interview.
Right. It doesn't mean it's factual.
Well, yeah. And the thing is, just in case listeners are listening to this, and – because we got weird flack from that. And in particular,
a lot addressed at me because I wrote an article about it. And as I've had to – look, I'm not doing the Blumhouse.com thing anymore, thankfully.
Yes.
And the thing is, the second he said it, I sighed because I knew that if some other website took his quotes and ran something from my show, then I would be terrible at my job. And so I don't regret it. But that's the point is like –
Honestly, you can't really regret it. It's something that happened.
People have been talking about that for 30 years.
Yes.
Yeah, this is one of the biggest. And also, look, there's a couple other things. Number one, who gives a fuck because you made Chainsaw?
I know. That's
exactly.
You made a better movie.
You're not,
one of the best movies ever made.
Anything.
That is always my point, is that I'm not that big a fan of Poltergeist, to be quite frank.
I've heard you say this before.
I actually love Poltergeist. I love Poltergeist, and it was a big influence as a kid. But the other thing is, let's say one perspective was completely true either way. Regardless, that movie's not the same movie without both of them being there.
That's true.
Exactly.
Right?
True.
So the chemistry of alchemy of filmmaking is not one or the other.
Yes.
It's just always endlessly fascinating. So I don't even know if you can tell us what you know because I don't know if you're allowed
probably
to.
Probably can't.
Yeah.
So but if I'm going to give like a general overview of – so one of the things that was interesting was 2007, 2009, Warner Brothers was trying to put out a special edition Blu-ray of Poltergeist, which they did. And it ended up having this VAM, this bonus material –
that had nothing to do with the movie.
It was all about paranormal investigations.
Yeah, and you're like, what's this?
And it was crap. And it was like, okay, you have a movie that everybody wants to hear this story. Everybody wants to hear what happened. Everybody wants to hear details about how it was shot, how it was filmed. And I would get him to talk to me about all that stuff all the time. Yeah. He was there.
Yeah.
He was present.
Oh, yeah.
My understanding, and I had a big, big fight with Mike Williamson about this once, because Mike actually, Mike doesn't, he agrees that it's a Spielberg movie.
Well,
much of a Toby Hooper person as Mike is.
And let's keep in mind, for people who don't really understand the whole situation, regardless of who directed it, it would still, even if Toby was directing every second, it still was a Spielberg film because it was written, developed, and produced, which in Hollywood means, so there's a lot of murkiness anyway.
Yes. I mean, we had many, because I was fascinated by it, but they were trying to put together this Blu-ray, and they wanted him to come in and do an on-camera, and they wanted him to come in and do a commentary. And we were really close at that point. And he just said, look, dude, like they called me again. And he said, their deadline is looming for this thing. And they really want me to come in. And I said, so go in, dude, tell your side of the story. And he said, side of the story. I said, Toby, tell your side of the story. He said, Steven's not going in. Frank Marshall's not going in. If Steven's not talking, I'm not talking either.
Yeah. So he's super loyal.
Loyal.
No, and there's a lot to be respected about that.
And they worked together a lot. They did Taken. They did the Sci-Fi Channel miniseries together.
Oh, yeah.
They did the Amazing Stories thing.
Thing about the story the guy did say here, I don't feel like he was questioning. I mean, it sounded, if anything, the reason why it sounded believable, whether it's true or not, is it sounded like they both knew the score.
Yes.
And this was what they had to do to make this movie.
Yes.
So it didn't feel like Spielberg took over a movie because Toby was incompetent. That wasn't what it was.
And that's what he had to live with.
That's the
impression.
I would rather, whatever the truth be out there, because it makes them both look like professionals.
Right, right.
Versus one person had to be a certain, you know. We don't know, though. We'll never know.
Yeah, no, we'll never know. I mean, he gave me his side.
Yeah,
it doesn't mean that's 100% the truth either.
Yeah, no, I believe that.
But I felt like it was kind of a Richard Marquand Return of the Jedi kind of thing where you're making George Lucas's movie.
Yeah.
Or Willow for Ron Howard always said that was kind of miserable because he was making George's movie.
Yeah.
And I think that Toby was making Steven's movie and that Steven was on the set and very overbearing and just kind of saw when he saw something that he wanted to, when he had one of those Spielberg sparks, he just would step in and do whatever he wanted to do. And I don't think that Toby ever, I remember reading something that said that Toby just wouldn't kick him off the set because the DGA allows you to do that. The DGA actually gives you the power. You can call the DGA and they can send a representative down and they can have somebody, they can have the producer basically removed from the set, and it's perfectly
legit. Steven Spielberg.
It's Steven Spielberg.
You know, really
at the height,
popular.
At the height,
ET's happening right then.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
it'd be like I'm sure it'd be the same if Spielberg were doing AI for Kubrick.
Right.
And Kubrick was sitting behind him.
Right.
He'd probably let Kubrick do whatever the fuck
he
wanted.
Totally. Yeah.
I think what's important to take away from this, and people if they get upset, because I actually understand that getting upset about your heroes and what they have did or didn't do. Look, it's not something we'll ever be able to solve. The point being, though, and what I like that you've just brought up is that even though Spielberg was the engine and it was, you know, his film going into it, it's so cool to know, but that never happened without Toby.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Toby decided the book. This is all connected.
Yes.
Without one person, you don't have the film you love.
Right.
So if you love that film, then just accept that everyone helped make that movie.
Right.
And
right.
You know what I mean?
And sometimes that's directing a movie is not the kind of picture that
be
you
all
have in your
and
head.
End all.
Yeah. Sometimes you're answering to producers.
Yeah. Or Tour Theory made that into a thing. And, right. And so, because somebody has to be responsible.
Right.
So when it's movie's good, director's great. When it's bad, director bad.
Right.
It's because it's an easier method.
Right.
Yeah.
But you're right. It's more complex.
It's always a team.
But he loved Steven. They stayed in touch. They worked together many times afterwards. So like anything that was... if you were to look at the Poltergeist controversy on face value and say, you know, Steven Spielberg came in and ghost directed the movie because Toby was incompetent and, you know, it was a disaster and it's all Steven Spielberg, then why the fuck would they stay in touch and continue to work together? Right, and it doesn't make any sense.
It could also open up an interesting question because DJ never allowed co-directing.
Correct.
And so
that was the other issue.
That's why some people have left. Rodriguez, Tarantino, a lot of people.
Yes.
So maybe you're looking at a movie where there's a clear case where it's literally a co-directed and maybe different parts movie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the way kind of Spielberg told it at the time was like, A, he couldn't do two movies at the same time. He couldn't do E.T. and it was just the guild and the studios. There's no way. It's illegal. And then the DGA also has this thing about two directors. Yeah. You can't do that.
Yeah,
so he was just kind of trying to...
It's the mystery that's made it a mystery.
Yeah.
The fact that they couldn't say because of DGA policy has then created a genuine mystery.
Right.
And us as fans always want to know, but it's not personal. And it's not about... It doesn't mean we are ever disrespecting somebody whose work we've grown up loving.
Right.
No. That's absurd. It really is.
Yeah,
and I do take offense to that idea because we are just... asking questions.
Yeah.
We're not giving answers. We're asking questions.
I probably shouldn't have even told you that story, to be honest.
Well, but I think it's a good button to that conversation.
You know what's interesting? Well, yeah, and I think that the final button that I would like to add to it is if you look at the visual style of Poltergeist and the visual style of Life Force and the visual style of Invaders from Mars, it's the same guy.
Yeah.
Now, Spielberg's influence is nowhere to be found in Life Force or Invaders from Mars, although Invaders from Mars is kind of trying to be in like an Amblin movie in its own weird kind of way. But most of Life Force and Invaders from Mars are shot with the wide angle, like the fisheye lens. Mm-hmm. And if you look at Poltergeist, the edges of the frame, they're always curved. Everything has got this weird where it's drawing you in. And
whose DP was it?
That's a good question.
Who had worked with the DP before?
Hold on.
Well, was it Leonetti? Was it
sitting in front of a device?
He was the...
No, but his brother shot it.
Was he the main DP, though?
Yeah,
or was
I thought so, too.
Camera operator.
Hold on, guys.
Well, we're trying to say who worked with him before that.
Yeah, because that's usually something that really helps build the visual style. Maybe they're both one-offs. I don't know.
But with the lens flares and everything
else,
like there's
the
a visual... Was it?
Leonetti was the DP, of course.
Okay.
So before that, he had done a ton of stuff.
Did he work with either of them,
Let me bump up to where it is.
While we're having that break, I just want to, before we forget, I can't forget that the most important thing Toby Hooper ever did for me personally, because I just am forgetting, because Chainsaw I saw older, I was like 18 or something, is absolutely Salem's Lot.
Absolutely.
Nothing freaked me out more than the floating child, and that is actually my favorite vampire of all time. That vampire
I think that was my introduction to Nosferatu. Nosferatu was.
I didn't either.
Vampire, and I always thought, like, oh my god, that is terrifying.
It just changed like what you thought of as TV and movies. I love that film so much. I think
me
it
too.
Still really works.
Did you see it as a kid? Did you see it?
That's what I mean. No, I saw it young.
Yeah,
on
I did
TV,
too.
So you never forget the tapping
Kinder
on
trauma
the window.
For sure.
I didn't see it until a couple of years ago. Right, I actually I talked about it on Killer POV when I'd first seen it, where my husband, it was like his most haunting movie ever, and he would get like he would always tap on the glass, and I knew what he was referencing. But I was always like, but he was like, it's the scariest thing I've ever seen. And so then we watched it, and it did not kinder trauma me. Like, I was definitely.
When you're older,
But I can see how, as a kid, that would be terrifying.
Yeah,
and no, as best I can tell, Leonetti did not work with
either of them before that.
Yeah. So that was Toby bringing his visual style to his other movies.
Yeah.
And it's there. And I swear to God, some of Invaders from Mars is all wide angle lens. There's a scene, there's a wide shot of a gas tanker that's going to explode. Driving past the camera from left to right, and it folds. It does that thing where something gets too close to a wide angle, and the middle gets fat, and the sides get skinny. And the whole movie is shot like that. There's a banister that curves, like, and it's not curving, but it's the same stuff you see in Poltergeist. So to me, it's like, this is a gray, weirder thing than people, you know.
Again, they're both
and
there.
Talking to him about it as well.
Yeah, they're both there.
But Salem's Lot, honestly, like, I mean, that freaked me out when I was a kid, and I didn't know who he was. I didn't know who Stephen King was.
Yeah,
I just knew that there was going to be a scary movie on TV.
Yeah,
but if it was on TV, then it must be okay. It's coming on primetime. It must be all right. No.
Kids are never okay when you're a kid. No. Dead kids when you're a kid, that's scary.
But all of the scary stuff. I love all this. There's the first Barlow attack that is in the jail cell. There's that bit where the guy's falling asleep in the jail cell in the sheriff's station. And Barlow's hand just kind of comes into frame and brushes up against the lock on the cell door. And it unlocks and clicks and just kind of slowly, wings open. Ah!
Yeah.
My God. It's just terrifying. And then his head pops up with the growl. But it's the scene. So, the kid at the window. And then the thing where the room starts to shake and the parents are talking. They're having the hard talk with the priest about how their son is obsessed with horror films and they want him to stop. They want him to be more normal. And then the room starts to shake and all the plates and all of the stuff starts to break and fall off the shelves. And then this black thing falls on the floor.
Oh, yes. Oh,
and starts to unfold and rise up. Yeah. And it's the first real, full appearance of Mr. Barlow.
Yeah.
Mr. Barlow. And it's
Mason,
terrifying. James Mason's so good in it. So, no, I mean, that to me.
But also, it's the movie that he made where I feel he could have been a big, 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 big time, bankable. Like, you watch that and go, oh, that guy could be a director. It doesn't feel like he's just injecting his Toby-ness in that one. It feels like he's just showing how good a director he could have been.
Yep. And he broke some molds there. Yeah. I mean, that was a real game changer. And that they got in so much trouble for, parents' groups came out.
I believe it was
a disaster.
He's subversive. He continually was subversive. Every film seems to have something that he's getting in there.
I just rewatched it actually night before last. And
how's it look on Blue? I haven't watched the Blue.
Amazing.
The Blue's wonderful. Okay. Yeah.
Oh my God. I couldn't believe it. Like, it shouldn't look as good as it looks, but it looks amazing. Yeah. But something I was actually going to say to Rob was, watching it this time, I picked up on a lot of Fright Night in Salem's Lot.
Oh yeah.
Well, there's the big old ugly house where the new person has moved in that's a vampire.
Okay.
There's the big staircase where they have the fight with the familiar where they keep shooting him and he won't die.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
There's the stained glass behind the staircase.
But is that just old New England houses? I mean, that's how Stephen King wrote it.
But it's the sequences. And then the female lead turns into a sexy vampire with a white dress.
Oh.
And it's like, wow.
I'm going to ask Tom
about
that.
Ask Tom about how much of an influence, because
I know he loved Toby. He was actually spoke to him after the news got out, and he really did love him a lot.
Well, I'd heard that he was talking to Toby last week.
Yeah.
And I was someone that all four of us know that I can't divulge was actively talking to me all through August about getting White Zombie back up on its feet with Toby directing it.
Wow. And he honestly, Ryan was talking about getting him on this show.
Really? Mm-hmm.
And I know Mick Garris said that he was booked for Postmortem as well. So we wanted to bring him on specifically after the Leonette, that got out, well, then let's bring Toby on.
Yeah.
He also was,
he shied away from ever talking.
Yeah. And in fact, I think I read somebody say that was the first thing he'd say is, I can't talk about Poltergeist. Yeah. And it's like, okay.
He wouldn't.
But we still
all those masters of horrors, they all seem to love him.
Yes.
All the guys, he seems to be the one people love. And it just, it tells you a lot how rattled they all were by his passing and how sad everyone is about it.
It was devastating. It was devastating. If you knew him, he was, he felt like a family member.
Yeah.
You know, and he really was a father figure to me. We had a conversation once where he noticed that we'd had many, many conversations over the phone talking about the script, and I would have to fax him pages because he hated email. And he said, dude, I noticed you don't swear when you talk to me. And I said, you noticed that? He said,
you don't really swear at all.
No, I do.
Not
occasionally. But anyway, what he picked up on was that I don't swear to my parents. He's like, you don't swear to your parents, do you? I said, no. He said, so you don't swear when you talk to me because you see me as a father figure.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, all right, Dad. Thanks for psychoanalyzing me.
Well, guys, we are running out of time.
Yeah.
My last note. Check out his Freddy's Nightmares, the pilot.
Yes. Yeah. No more Mr. Nice Guy.
I love that episode.
He got to do Freddy Krueger's origin, and I think it's one of the best Freddy things out there.
Yeah. It's really a nice little piece.
Oh, and I promised I would plug, I'm going to be starring in a five-part Earbud Theater episode that's going to start in September and run through October. It's called After the Haunting, and it actually is almost kind of a Poltergeist type sequel. What would what would happen the day after the house disappeared in Questa Verde with the rest of the neighborhood?
Wow.
Cool.
But I starred in it, and it's the first time that Earbud's doing a five-part thing. I didn't write it. They just cast me as one of the two leads, and I'm really excited about it, and I promised that I would push it. And Jackals comes out on Friday, September 1st. It's only in 10 screens, but it's also going to be on demand and iTunes.
Watch that. Watch a Tobey Hooper film
yes.
in honor of him.
Yeah.
We've lost too many giants.
Yes.
Yeah. And we don't. And my T-shirt can't bear one more.
I know. I've been staring at your T-shirt, getting choked up this whole time.
Excellent. And we will be back next week from a very special location.
Slashback video.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Slashback video.
Great.
So we will see you all then. Thanks so much.
Thanks, guys.